Ahoy, mateys! Welcome to the GameBuoy.org video game podcast, your twice monthly port of call for video game news and views that maybe aren't on your radar, but most definitely should be. I'm your host, Captain Spike 2099, and with me, as always, is First Mate Slaggy McWaggy 2.
Actually, it's Super McWaggy World 2, Slaggy's Island. Thank you very much.
Welcome once again, each and every one of our lovely and beautiful listener, to another episode of the GameBuoy.org video game podcast.
GameBuoy.org video game podcast.
Today is March 15th, 2016, and this is GameBuoy Podcast episode 191, Designing Women, Interior Design in Games. This week, we're going to be taking a look at an interesting niche subgenre that is somehow paradoxically also one of the sales heavyweights of the industry. We're talking, of course, about games focused on interior design. It's somewhat interesting, but from The Sims to Animal Crossing, these types of titles are often thought of as non-games by the judgmental hardcore, and I will admit with a certain shame that I have, once upon a time, fallen into such flawed thinking thereof. Yet these massively successful games end up consuming hundreds to thousands of hours of players' lives and topping the sales charts, regardless of how casual they slash we might be.
Hey, as a casual they, I resemble that remark.
So I thought, you know, it was time really to sit down and take a look at our experiences with this gameplay mechanic and the subgenre, or perhaps even subgenres, that it has inspired. So that's what we have on deck here today. But before we get into all that, let's get started, relax, and talk about some games news. Slaggy, what is the way that we rhyme?
So, lately there has been a lot of news trickling out about the long-rumored next-gen Xbox PC. It has been revealed as codename Project Helix. It will play your Xbox and PC games. I say revealed, it's really just that it has been officially confirmed that it is going to be a thing. Despite rumors, the new CEO of Xbox, Asha Sharma, was not, quote, given a blank check, end quote, for the project. So do with that as you will. And it, to me, the most interesting thing here, and something that I personally agree with, is coming from analyst Dr. Serjan Toto, who is the CEO and founder of the Japanese game industry consultant Kantan Games. Dr. Toto said, "This might be Microsoft's last attempt to make their hardware business work. I believe there is nobody in this industry who believes there will be another Xbox if this next machine fails." Oof, harsh, but true.
Yeah.
And the only other piece of news we have right now is that dev kits will not even be sent out until 2027, so we're definitely quite a ways off. And with the price of RAM, were you expecting anything sooner?
Right. So we even have two more little Xbox pieces, but I want to break down what we have so far already and sort of why it's worth talking about, right? We noted last episode that kind of neither of us thought the next Xbox would meaningfully necessarily even get out the door. Technically speaking, I'm still kind of hedging my bets on this thing, but I will say that Asha Sharma really standing on this announcement and even getting a little more detailed than I had really expected anyone at Microsoft to get about Project Helix does make me think that probably Project Helix will come to fruition now. I still don't know that I really think it's gonna be a mass market console that is trying to achieve the same penetration that Microsoft has previously been trying to attain. But like I'm still really trending more towards a branded PC type situation. But it does at least sound like for this first iteration of Project Helix that, they're still, at least on the face of it, trying to be a part of the console space as well. It's also interesting to me that dev kits are not being sent out until 27, we've heard about how Sony and Microsoft supposedly want their next boxes out in 27, even though it looks like the market is likely to make that somewhat difficult. If you're trying to launch a powerful new box in 2027, your dev kits shouldn't also be going out in 2027. The best example of that kind of thinking I can point to is the Switch 2 situation we saw last year, where there was a lot of word that dev kits didn't go out early enough. And as a result, we did see some kind of weird ports and a lot of developers who we thought would be present at launch not making launch. So I'm really worried about the state of Xbox, even as Xbox is doing everything to reassure us, which is really what, to me, the through line here is that Microsoft must have heard the chatter and they're really trying to double down on like, no, guys, it's really happening. I promise.
No, we're not dead, says Walking Corpse.
Ah, but you've got it almost exactly right with that, I think. So this next update is predominantly interesting because I think it gives us a sense of where Xbox is moving. This is word, and it is being reported over on Kotaku. We will link you over at GameBuoy.org.
Over at GameBuoy.org.
And of course, you know, over at GameBuoy.org, we try to post the show roll, including a guide to all of the links of all of the news stories that we talk about here on this episode. We wouldn't be able to do the work we do on this show if not for the hard work of reporters at outlets like Kotaku. So we do definitely recommend that you dig into some of these links if you're interested in learning more about any of the issues that we talk about here or on any of our episodes. That having been said, Kotaku notes that Xbox is retiring the controversial "This is an Xbox" marketing campaign. This is, of course, the marketing campaign that suggested that basically any screen could become an Xbox. You know, TVs, other consoles, your computer, your phone. When they were really trying to hype like the Stream Anywhere type of approach that it looked like they were really going to be dialing into, the initiative of like porting their software on day one to every platform, I think that this marketing campaign made a lot of sense at that time. In the initial days following the big leadership change at Xbox, however, I did see a lot of the leadership at Xbox on social media seemingly responding to fan demands for like exclusivity and what have you. And, you know, I saw a lot of people reposting messages of Asha Sharma supposedly saying, you know, message received about players not liking that platform agnostic approach, you know. So I do really wonder if we're not going to see this last ditch effort at Microsoft to sort of try and redouble down on platform exclusivity. I don't really think that's going to be the business. I kind of feel like Pandora's box has been opened and now you're just going to cut off your new potential customer base that you potentially have just activated and are now going to alienate. I'm very confused with what Microsoft is doing right now.
Yeah.
And then you had another news story, and I think this also sort of ties in with, you know, Asha Sharma and the AI of it all.
Do I have to?
Unfortunately.
So, we also have word that Gaming Copilot is coming to current-gen consoles. Cool. That's all I'm saying about it, sorry.
Okay, so Gaming Copilot, as it exists on, for example, the Rogue Xbox Ally, or I guess it's available on PC and mobile in beta already, you can use it sort of as like a live guide to be like, tell me what materials I need to craft a gear in this game. And then in theory, it can just straight up give you the information you need, which I get the idea of why people would think this is helpful. But given the way that they're achieving this implementation, I just don't really want it. In fact, there's kind of a lot of that. Like, who is this for? Who wants this? Who wants to have any of their, like, system power overhead being used for this? Like, I would rather that system overhead be being freed up if you don't need those resources for the operating system, you know? So there's just like a lot of layers on it. But if I'm going to be really honest and I'm going to really take off my conspiracy theorist, put on my conspiracy theorist glasses for a minute, I actually believe that this is just to juice their co-pilot numbers, because they can basically say, you know, if there's, call it 50 million Xbox Series consoles out there, then they can tell their shareholders, oh, we just added 50 million new co-pilot users. And it allows them to, on paper, make their numbers look really good. That's what I think this is really about, because this isn't a feature anyone wants. It's not a feature anyone's going to use. And I really, from a tech perspective, think it's kind of a lose-lose on the implementation. But it does give Asha Sharma a feather to put in their cap. So, you know, for the as far as juicing the numbers, so to me, that seems like the most likely explanation, sort of the Occam's razor of it all. Do you have anything to add, Slaggy?
I mean, if you need to know materials or how to solve a puzzle or something, just go look up a game facts like the rest of us do. I kind of hope that it, like, Gaming Copilot, like, gives someone, like, incredibly wrong information because of the AI of it all. And it's like, oh, Gaming Copilot just led me into something that caused a game-breaking bug and it deleted my save data.
Right. I can't wait for someone
to be like, yeah.
I can't wait for someone to be like, I asked Gaming Copilot how to unlock Zelda in Nickelodeon All-Stars 2, and it said I had to beat the game as Cat Dog 17 times. Oh my god, guys, Zelda's in Nickelodeon All-Stars 2.
I can only imagine.
Yeah, I mean, fundamentally, the tech hallucinates. It's my understanding that the tech will always hallucinate, so it just doesn't seem like a good solution for this.
Yeah.
All right, moving on. We had a minor kerfuffle on the internet, which is why this is a hot topic. The update, of course, suggests it might not be a hot topic anymore. This was word last week that Valve's Steam Machine website had listed the upcoming hardware as hopefully shipping in 2026. They then noted, you know, about how they had recently shared about some of the memory and storage shortages. Storage shortages is always a tough one for me to say. You know, how it's created challenges for them. A lot of us, of course, took this to mean, you know, that there's a very real possibility that they might miss that 2026 window, as has been previously rumored. As of March 6th, it is worth noting that Valve has updated the blog post on their website and has said that they will be shipping all of their previously announced products as a part of this initiative, you know, the controller, the machine, and the headset, in 2026, as had been announced in 2025. We'll see if they hold to that, of course. This is one of those things where we keep hearing this pop up. It's hard for me not to believe there's not fire where we're getting all this smoke. My thought is maybe if they do ship this year, it's more of a smaller shipment of like, hey, we made our launch date, with like the more meaningful stock to follow in 2027. Do you have any thoughts on this one?
I mean, this is one machine console that I was actually interested in, so boo.
Yeah, I feel that. It's definitely going to depend on price for me for all of these things, but I'm very interested in that headset. I've noted that I really like VR, and the only thing presently keeping me out of that space is Meta's current domination of it. So having a non-Meta option would really make a big deal for me.
I obviously can't do the VR headset stuff, but I would be interested in the little Steam box.
Yeah. Let's see. We also had word here. This was a major news story last week. Bloomberg reported last Saturday that per a NetEase spokesperson, they are going to be no longer funding Toshihiro Nagoshi-san's new studio, Nagoshi Studio Inc., starting in May, according to Bloomberg, they had had their own sources within the studio that indicated they were informed of this decision only the first Friday of this month. Nagoshi Studio, of course, announced its first game, Gang of Dragon, during the Game Awards last December. We actually talked about this a fair bit because, you know, we're fans of Nagoshi. We're really looking forward to this game. This is a major bummer. It has a lot of us, I think, very concerned. NetEase is one of the other big studios internationally funding a lot of growth in the industry, similar to like Tencent and how we talked last week about some of the ripple effects when Tencent pulls out of funding a given project. Now we're seeing that happening with NetEase this week and Nagoshi Studio Inc. I do understand the idea, of course, that Nagoshi Studio has been being funded by NetEase for years and they still haven't shipped a game. They only just finally announced one a few months ago. But like, yeah, that's AAA development. What did y'all think was going to happen? We're linking a news story here over at Anime News Network. They kind of also note that NetEase back in 2024 had laid off most of the staff at Uka Studios. And that, you know, they had just shipped Visions of Mana at the time. When that happened, I was actually really kind of gutted because I thought that Visions of Mana remake was really well done. And the fact that the staff was effectively laid off before the game even shipped was, to me, a major bummer. So definitely a very concerning trend when the people bringing the money into the industry to fund these big projects is now pulling that money out. Again, seeing stories related to this pretty much every week, it feels like now. Slaggy, what are your thoughts on that one?
I hate it.
Yeah. This story actually has me thinking about bringing back the follow-up segment that we used to do, right?
Right.
We talked a little bit about this last week, about how a fair number of enthusiast reporters had been talking about they were hearing from their various sources that Sony Interactive was no longer going to be releasing their PS5 games on PC, and particularly not day and date. Earlier this month, Bloomberg reported that basically, according to people familiar with the company's plans, per their sources, not only is Sony Interactive no longer going to be doing the PC ports, but they've actively scrapped major PC port projects that had been in the work in recent weeks. Stuff like Ghost of Yote and Saros will apparently now be being totally exclusive to PS5, while the games that have online components, such as Marathon, Marvel Tokon, supposedly will still be receiving PC ports. Bloomberg did contact a spokesperson for Sony to try and get a comment. Sony declined to comment, unfortunately. I still think we're going to, you know, sort of like I said last week, I think we're going to see a situation where Sony will do ports when games are older, and maybe some of the games that they develop with their partners and online games, that makes a lot of sense too. And yeah, otherwise, I think we'll see them try to stand on exclusivity driving users to their hardware. And, you know, I think Nintendo has shown us that there is a path there. You just have to have actually unique software that isn't just a consistent rehash of the software you did last year. In many cases, literally, you know, releasing the same Last of Us game every other year.
Yeah, it's interesting that people are being more exclusive these days, but I don't know.
Yeah, well, and I want to back that up a little bit with, you know, there was a news story here from GamesIndustry.biz.
GamesIndustry.biz.
Excellent. I hoped you picked that up. And they ran the article, and the title basically sums it up, but sales data indicates Sony's PS5 ports are increasingly losing audience share on PC, but only because of release timing, which basically is what it says on the tin. You know, the initial wave of PC ports initially, it seems, did pretty well. But according to analysts, it basically looks like a lot of the total players, when they're releasing, you know, simultaneously, people are picking up more on PC. But when these games are releasing way in advance on PlayStation, they're picking up on PlayStation and then not on PC. I think this tracks to my own experiences. I know initially when Sony just started porting games, I picked up a couple of them just because I was interested. And then I kind of stopped because it's like, I played these games on my console already. But it's kind of interesting. This data paired with the news story we just reported makes me feel like Sony was at kind of a impasse where they really had to commit to either day and date ports or just doing, you know, way delayed ports and really not focusing on PC as much. And it sounds like that's the direction they're going to go. Did you interpret the data any differently?
Nope.
All right. Well, then what do you got for us?
Well, we have some updates about Fortnite and Android. So Epic has announced that Fortnite will be returning to Android. Google has done some things to kind of open up their Android platform for app publishers. Basically, what I was able to gather from this is one of the big things is they're kind of decoupling the service fees and the billing. My understanding is that you used to have to use their billing system. So if you use your own billing system or an outside billing system, I know that was one of the sticking points for Epic about, you know, feeling like they were losing money on all those V-Bucks and stuff. And then there are going to be lower service fees as well. There's going to be a registered app store. I don't know if this is already in Android. I am not an Android user. So I guess this is good news for Epic Games.
Yeah, well, so it's actually good news in theory for everyone. In theory, this will possibly open the doors for other independent app stores to also reopen on, you know, the Android app store, other, you know, walled gardens to have their own little spaces present in this space again, which in theory, you know, kind of similar to what we saw from some of the recent Apple court decisions, right? So in theory, there could be industry positive knock-on effects to this. That's what I'm really hoping for. My bigger concern is something I'm going to talk about a little later this episode, but I think it's very interesting that we just heard news of Fortnite / Epic just having this big court victory, and then some other announcements that Epic has made recently. And I think it's worth thinking about the connective tissue between those two announcements. But we'll get to that.
We will.
We have one here, and this is a news story. I have to sort of watch my language in reporting on this. And it's kind of a major bummer to me in the modern day how many times I have to note that. But it is what it is. This is Word, and I'm going to link you via GamesBeat, who is talking about an article running over on Aftermath. This is, of course, the news that Nintendo is suing the United States government over the tariffs that the president put in place last year. This is, of course, per a complaint that was filed in the U.S. court system. Right this moment, the Supreme Court has suggested that the tariffs are not on the up and up. As a result, we have seen a lot of talk about various companies, corporations, employers, what have you, looking to seek to recover funds. Word that Nintendo has actually filed suit is fascinating. I know some of the other companies that have filed suits include, you know, Costco, FedEx. I'm going to just try and keep as evenly spoken as I can while hopefully communicating what I mean. I hope that the people who are correct are successful in court.
Indeed. You go, Nintendo.
We also have word here following the success that Resident Evil Requiem has found in the aftermath of its immediate release. We have already gotten confirmation that Requiem will be adding a new story DLC, as well as new minigames. We do not yet know what type of minigame is going to be added. A lot of us are, of course, expecting it to be like a mercenaries mode or a raid mode. Of course, because these have been popular minigames in previous iterations of the series. But we don't quite know yet. They basically said, you know, they're hard at work on it. They ask for our patience and hope that we'll look forward to it. And I will say I am looking forward to it. I think it's cool that they're adding going to be doing story DLC. I think it's cool that they're going to be adding the minigame, especially given that the series has a history of minigames like this. Just honestly, big win for Capcom, and I'm happy to see that the effort they clearly put into Requiem is paying off.
I hope that it's a Leon Kennedy dating sim.
Ah, that would be cute.
So, remember Highgarde?
It's back in Pog form.
No, it's gone. It is officially dead. It ended service on March 12th, only 45 days after launch. What the fuck? Like, what was even the point of doing this? You know, they mentioned in their, like, post about it that we have not been able to build a sustainable player base. Well, I want to tell you what's not sustainable is flooding the market with live service games that can't stay afloat, which wastes time and talent of developers who are treated as a disposable workforce. Can we stop with that, please?
Yeah.
Ooh, I got a little heated. I got to watch my blood pressure there. I also wanted to point you in the direction on GameBuoy.org.
GameBuoy.org.
Where we post all the links to every article we discuss. Ethan Gatch on Kotaku wrote almost like a eulogy for the game, and I just thought it was really kind of poignant. You know, I didn't play the game, but, you know, Ethan mentions that it was kind of was a janky game, but that didn't stop the fun that was had. So stop killing games, basically.
Yeah. I think we've been pretty clear on our feelings about these kinds of things. So I'm just going to note that I think it really sucks that Highgarde met the fate it ended. I thought that I fell in love with Highgarde article was really good. 45 days, man, the game never had a chance. That really fucking sucks.
Yeah.
All right. I have a series of cool news here, and then we'll get into our release updates. The original game in the Kena series, Kena: Bridge of Spirits, is coming to Switch 2 this spring. This is, of course, the game that is already available on PlayStation and Xbox families, as well as PC. But now, of course, Switch 2 users will get to experience it before the new game comes out. This is, of course, noteworthy. Slaggy, I know you and I both have indicated an interest in checking this game out after the sequel was recently announced. I did not get around to picking it up on another console, so I think I will pick it up when it hits Switch 2.
Yeah, I know a lot of people are, like, kind of making Switch 2 their primary console, so that's great. I did find a good price for a PS4 copy, which will give you an auto upgrade to PS5, so I personally went that route, but that sounds like a great option for people who want to play this.
Excellent. We also got the announcement of the release date for Yoshi and the Mysterious Book, as well as a new trailer. This is, of course, going to be releasing on May 21st. I'm really excited for the game. It looks like it's shaping up well. The aesthetic looks really solid. I don't know. New Yoshi is always a good time. Are you looking forward to this one?
Yeah, I mean, I love that they always go for cool aesthetics with really every Yoshi game since forever, so.
Yeah.
This promises to be more of that.
Indeed. And then we also got the announcement of a new anime action RPG. And in this case, I literally mean an action RPG based off a licensed anime IP. This is a new Sword Art Online game. This is called Echoes of Einkrad. It is an action RPG, and it's, to me, looks very much like in the vein of Tales of Arise. That's actually kind of a potent combination. I have some, how do we say this? problems with Sword Art Online in a larger sense, because unfortunately it falls very much into the, like, I'm in love with my sister type tropes of storytelling.
I was just going to say, is it the incest?
Right. But, you know, if in this game where you are kind of creating a custom character and going through the Aincrad setting, I could see some promise because, again, if we remove that stuff from the setting that I don't like, I actually like a lot of other stuff from the setting.
Yeah.
This game was just announced, but it's releasing July 10th worldwide, so please look forward to it. Psyche, did you have any thoughts on that one before we move into our release updates?
It's just so funny that you were alluding to the incest, because that's all I think about with Sword Art Online now. And wasn't it, it was that the, like, his cousin who was raised as his sister, like, they found each other in the game, and she had a crush on him, and he didn't know it was her, and she didn't know it was him.
More or less, yeah.
Yeah, it's still weird, but yeah. I otherwise enjoyed that anime, so this might be a good time.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. All right, then, let us move on to our release updates. All right, first off, we have word here that Mini Shoot Adventures is now available on PlayStation 5, Xbox Series, Switch 2, Xbox One, and Switch. This was released as a shadow drop at a Nintendo Indies event. We're not going to talk about every announcement that came out there, but we will mention a couple of them here. This specific title is a shmup Zelda clone. I know it has a lot of fans. When I saw this trailer, Slaggy, I actually thought immediately of you.
I'll have to check that out. Sounds really cute.
Yeah, I think it'd be right up your alley. We also got the announcement that Blueprints is now available for Switch 2. This was announced at that same event. This was one of our goatees, which is what we used to call the Booyah Awards, the goatees. That's available now as well. Slaggy, I know that for you was a particular favorite last year. I played Blueprints when I still had a Game Pass sub, so I kind of think when I try it again, which I will because I tend to go back to games even when they didn't hit for me and give them a second chance, I'm kind of thinking maybe I'll give it a go on Switch too.
I can imagine playing it handheld would be great because you could kind of like take it on the go and be like, ooh, I am sitting waiting in the doctor's office. I'm going to try to do a run and see if I can get to the final room.
Given my life lately, that is a pretty useful use case.
Oh, no.
Let's see. We also have word here that this week, Digimon Story Time Strangers 3rd DLC pack came out. This is the additional Digimon and Episode Pack 3, Anti-Paradox. I believe with this launch on March 12th, that makes up the entirety of the current roster of announced DLC for Digimon Story Time Stranger. I believe all three DLCs will be available at launch when the game gets its Switch 2 port. Hopefully with the Switch 2 port coming, maybe they'll do another set of DLC. Namco Bandai has been really generous in the DLC space with some of these anime franchises. Particularly, I'm thinking about some of the Dragon Ball games that have gotten DLC after DLC. I would love to see that kind of longevity for Digimon Story. We also have word that the new Arc System Works action-adventure game, Daemon and Baby, will have a demo version on Nintendo Switch, Steam, PS5, and PS4, available starting March 18th. This demo will be available indefinitely and will have no time limits on the gameplay experience therein. We also got the announcement that Marvel Maximum Collection, this was announced during our last episode, is going to be getting a release in just a scant 2 more weeks, specifically March 27th. Sigma Star Saga DX, this is a port of an old GBA game, is going to be releasing on April 7th. Incombini is getting a Switch 2 version that will be launching April 30th. Mixtape is going to be getting a Switch 2 version. That will be launching May 7th. Densha Attack, which we've spoken of previously, is getting a Switch 2 version and has a demo available now. It will be launching, the full version will be launching on Switch 2 come June 17th. Rattatan is going to be launching on Switch 2, PS5, Xbox X and S, and PC on July 16th. That's, of course, exciting. We knew Rattatan was coming. We had had it previously in early release. Hearing that it's going to be on all of these platforms on July 16th is great news. And last, but certainly not least, before we get to our retro releases, is word that Kyoto Xanadu is going to be launching in Japan and Asia on July 16th as well. This is, of course, likely not to be a worldwide release date, but now that the Japanese and Asia release dates have been confirmed, hopefully in the future we will get an announcement of a localization, as typically we have gotten the more recent iterations of this series localized. As for our retro release updates for Arcade Archives, on March 5th, we had Plump Pop. This is, of course, an arcade game by Taito, dated from 1987.
Why are you mad? Because my Plump Pop severely and yours don't?
We also have the Console Archives release from that same day, March 5th, was Nobunaga's Ambition. This is, of course, the NES/Famicom version. This is, of course, via Koei, before they were Koei Tecmo. The Famicom version released in 88. The NES version launched in 89. This is worth noting, in part, for actually having music by Yoko Kanno. Yes, that Yoko Kanno from, you know, Escaflowne, Macross, etc.
Cowboy Bebop?
Yeah, right.
Is there any other Yoko Kanno?
I mean,
statistically, yes, but only one who matters. Sorry, other people named Yoko Kanno out there.
Exactly that. One thing I'll also note is that when Hamster posted on their socials about Nobunaga's Ambition's release initially, they had posted that it was releasing a week earlier than the 5th, that it was releasing back in February. They ended up deleting that post and updating it to reflect the correct March 5th date. But that had left me with some hope that maybe the skip week with no Console Archives that we saw back in February was a mistake, you know, an error. I'm happy to say that I kind of think that still might be the case, but I'll get to that. On March 10th, so that was Mario Day, we did get a couple of Nintendo Switch Online Classics Plus Expansion Pack updates. This was the Game Boy Advance release Mario and Donkey Kong, itself a pseudo-sequel to the Mario 94 remake on Game Boy of the original Donkey Kong. I'm sorry, Donkey Kong 94, the semi-remake of the original Donkey Kong arcade game that was on Game Boy and Game Boy Super? Yeah, Super Game Boy.
Yeah.
And then this sequel, of course, births the Mario versus Donkey Kong series. And, you know, the Mario and Donkey Kong March of the Minis and all of that. And then we also got the Virtual Boy releases Mario Tennis, which is obviously quite a storied game upon itself, and Mario Clash, which is a 3D rendition utilizing multiple fields of play based on the original Mario Bros. Arcade game. So not Super Mario Bros., but, you know, the one-screen game where you're hitting monsters from below and knocking them off their little platforms. I actually think Mario Clash is an incredible version of that game type. I think it's a real bummer that there isn't a 2D viewing mode for these Virtual Boy games, because I think from a game design perspective, some of them do stand up, and I think it's a bummer that folks like you can't really enjoy them.
Alas.
Indeed. So then we got, this week, two releases. Of course, we got the Arcade Archives release for March 12th. This is the Neo Geo Poppin' Bounce release. That is, of course, a Neo Geo release. It was by Video System in 1997. And then on the on March 12th, we also got a Console Archives release. So 2 weeks in a row. And this was Sonic Wings Special, a PS1 release by Video System from 1996.
Oh, shit. Sonic has a Wings Special now? I hope it comes with chili cheese shots and a Route 44 blast.
Mm. Ah! That got me, girl. Overall, I'm excited about this. You know, this is a well-loved classic shmup. It definitely has its fans. I've already bought it and have poked around in it a bit. I think it's really cool to have this series still. I'm really delighted and chuffed. And like I said, I hope it continues to be a weekly release because for the most part, I am very interested in what they're putting down. So fingers crossed. All right. All of this having been done, all of this having been said, I think it's time to go to the club.
All right. First up, we have a very positive update on the situation we reported about previously with Ludovic Mbok. We had shared that he had been detained by immigration control. Obviously, language advisory here. He has been released on a low bond due to what the judge said was a show of support that had moved them. Yeah, there were 20 people in person and 20 online, and the judge was very moved.
Yeah, I you know, I have to watch my language when we talk about these kinds of issues. I think that it's very unfortunate that we have to watch our language when we talk about these things to the degree that we do. To that end, however, I can and will say, when we fight, we win. So continue fighting for your communities.
Right, right. Similarly, there are a lot of things that I could say, but what I will say is I'm very happy for Ludovic, hoping for the best outcome. There will be a formal hearing in May, but Ludovic's friends and family share that they are optimistic based on how the situation has proceeded so far.
Indeed. Let's see. We have another follow-up here. This one on Nacon. We had talked last week about how Nacon had filed for insolvency. And we had also noted how they were supposed to have an upcoming game showcase. That was going to be Nacon Connect. They have rescheduled for May. And I'm going to read you the full quote here because I think it sums it up. Faced with a difficult economic environment for the company, we are choosing to focus our resources on upcoming releases and the development of our current games. This period will allow us to polish our project and prepare for a new Nacon Connect to be held in May, which will showcase the work of our studios in the best possible way. And this to me just kind of reads like, you know, they wanted to have this Nacon Connect and then this other thing happened and they're reshuffling. I think that makes sense. And, you know, fingers crossed that it works out for them. We've seen too much bad happen in this industry over the last couple of years. At this point, I'm hoping everybody just stays together and stays formed and stays keeping everybody employed. Okay.
Please.
Right. We also have word here. Epic Games is actually suing a major Fortnite leaker. This is word that Adira FN Info allegedly, per filings, is being sued by Epic. Allegedly, Adira was an associate producer on contract at Epic. Epic alleges that the NDA violations that resulted are a infringement that constitutes a leaking of trade secrets. I hope that everything goes okay for Adira. I think this kind of pokes a big hole in a lot of the people who had thought that specific leaker was you know, a tool for Epic and like, oh, this is a controlled leak or whatever. Like, I don't know, girl, you don't file lawsuits against people who are doing controlled leaks. just very interesting case, probably one that we will keep an eye on and update you on if any interesting or precedent setting decisions come in. Do you have anything to say to that, or you can roll us forward?
The calls were coming from inside the house. So this one is really cool. This announcement was over on Eurogamer.net, and it was from indie studio Speculative Agency. They are currently working on a game called All Will Rise, which they describe as a narrative courtroom deck builder about ordinary people who make the powerful pay for destroying our future. Sounds like a power fantasy that I want to live out.
Dude,
love
right?
Late-stage capitalism.
Like, that description made me want to play that game so bad.
Right. Well, I am more likely than ever. I didn't know about this game until now, but I definitely want to support them, not just for that concept, but because they are, again, kind of standing for what they believe in. And they are returning funding that they got from Xbox and Microsoft to support the ongoing boycott of Microsoft. They have also called on other indies to boycott as well, saying, you know, that might mean lost revenue and losing an audience they would have gotten on Xbox, but them standing up for their beliefs and not taking dirty money, basically, is more important. So I applaud you, Speculative Agency.
Yeah, absolutely. This is a major plus for me. It really puts them on my radar in a positive way, and I will almost certainly check out this game as a direct result of them making this choice.
Indeed.
We also got word here that Tomb Raider 1 through 3 Remastered got a new Switch 2 release, as well as a free challenge mode to previously released versions of the game. I should also note, in addition to the Switch 2 release and update, that it also got a release on Google Play and iOS. This is interesting in the sense, of course, that it's adding, you know, new customization options to these classic games. I saw someone on my socials talking about how, I guess in the video, they see Lara fighting two T-Rexes at the same time. And I guess that's like a really scary thought. I am growing an appreciation for these older games through these collections that Aspyr has been doing. So I just think that adding some of these features is so cool. I don't know. The more people who can appreciate really well done re-releases, I think, is the better. And the more free content we get, I think, the better. So that's the rare win-win we talk about here on the show.
Yeah, just too bad that the French voices had been AI or whatever.
Yeah.
Possibly.
As we talked about previously, there was reason to believe that, although I think it remained technically unconfirmed, but it like seemed pretty likely. We also, and I feel bad because like, technically, I'm sharing this because I think it's so effing funny. But let me read you the headline of this article from over at PCGamer.com. You're not going to do it for that one, though?
PCGamer.com.
Thank you. This headline is, "Major investor is shocked and sad that the games industry is demonizing generative AI." And that headline just alone kind of made me laugh. This was apparently happening at like an adjacent meeting at the GDC event that happened this past week here in the Bay Area. Basically, they had representatives from multiple big tech companies as well as venture capital firms trying to talk about, you know, enthusiasm for generative AI. Unfortunately, as we had noted, that there was a recent GDC survey that had suggested that the majority of the industry does not think generative AI is good for the industry. We had Moritz Bayer-Lentz, this is the head of gaming at Lightspeed Venture Partners. This is a firm that invests in Anthropic, as well as a number of other AI companies that in fact, sometimes have stakes in Epic Games. He was noting that he feels that the games industry can capitalize on shifting trends in consumer and customer engagement, and then noted that he was shocked and sad that the industry hasn't embraced generative AI. I will note, like, dude is very good looking, according to the image that they shared of him on PC Gamer. So, like, good for you. You go, Glenn Coco. But also, like, I don't know, maybe it's from living in the pretty privileged bubble, but, like, everybody hates your product because it's slop and it's responsible for record layoffs and it's just not good. And I actually appreciate this article for basically saying that. It really goes into, like, just a little litany of reasons why people in the industry are not enthused for this. Gamers do not want it. And, like, my guy, like, yeah, people don't want this. Don't be shocked and sad. Get into a better industry.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Like, a panel at GDC about trying to drum up enthusiasm for generative AI in gaming is basically like the hetero awesome fest of gaming.
Yeah, right.
Nobody wants to go there, and it's just embarrassing.
Yeah.
All right. In some news that's more exciting than AI slop, although this is Ubisoft, so you never know, we got a Assassin's Creed brand update. You know, there had been a new appointment of leadership at the Assassin's Creed team. So we got the confirmation that Black Flag Resynced is a real thing. We got the announcement of a 60 frames per second update for Assassin's Creed Unity on PS5 and Xbox Series, and some updates on Codename Hex and Codename Invictus. So the information we have about Codename Hex is that it is a unique, darker, narrative-driven Assassin's Creed experience set during a pivotal moment in history.
Almost sounds a little like a pivot back to what they had been doing.
Right? I have snarky jokes I can make, but I have to watch my language. I will tell you off air. Although the feds are probably listening anyway. Right. And Invictus, codename Invictus, is a PvP multiplayer Assassin's Creed that is in the work, but didn't they have that in one of the games or a couple of the games as a game mode?
And they have They've experimented with multiplayer on a few different axes, including during the original release of Assassin's Creed Unity. So it's funny you say that. I will say also with this Assassin's Creed Unity update, I've seen multiple people saying, like, hey, this game is now super worth revisiting as, like, almost like a branch of history that didn't get developed on, like, oh, wow, they had a bunch of ideas for the series clearly that just weren't fully born and that they ultimately abandoned after this iteration was not well received due to all the technical stuff. But apparently, it's apparently, like, now really retrospectively interesting. And I'm sorry you were saying
that. Unity was the one with, like, the graphics glitch where you could, like, see the eyeballs really freakily, right?
Well, my understanding is that basically it was just too demanding a game for the generation they released it on. And that's why now they've done all of these, you know, new generation patches. And it's like, wow, we can finally experience the game that it was intended to be experienced as.
Oh, the Scarlet and Violet experience.
Yeah, right.
I hope that the multiplayer thing works out. But my thing is, if I was playing multiplayer Assassin's Creed, like, I want to be like, let you, me, Sulker, be, like, a guild of assassins, like, doing, like, asynchronous gameplay, like, trying to take out targets. That is an Assassin's Creed multiplayer that I would totally be into.
That would be really interesting. I do think they had some, like, team assassination stuff in Unity, where it's, like, oh, multiple people, maybe, like, one person's gonna, like, trigger the target to run and then someone else will be waiting for him up the alley to make the kill or whatever. And so, like, there are some cool ideas there, it seems, that kind of rubs up on what you're saying, although not identical.
Yeah, you know, I have my thoughts and feelings about Ubisoft, but, you know, we have both talked about our enjoyment of the franchise Assassin's Creed on the show. And all of this makes me want to kind of rediscover, revisit the franchise. I have not played in a very, very long time. Like, honestly, it was, I'm pretty sure it was the original Black Flag, and I didn't get far on it.
I still play most of these games, but especially when they announce updates for an older game like Unity that I didn't play. I skipped that one, even though I did eventually buy a copy for like $10, because I was like, someday they'll patch it. And now here we are, years later.
Oh, I think I did play like the first hour or so of Origin, the one that's set in ancient Egypt.
Oh, that's a good one, too. I'm a fan of these games. I have problems with Ubisoft. I typically try to pick these games up when they're on sale as a direct result, but I do enjoy them, the gameplay loops and what they do.
Absolutely.
Anyway, this is a exciting one for fans of the World of Darkness series of tabletop RPGs. We have word here. There was an update pushed to RoboCop Rogue City briefly last week that changed the game into an early build for an unannounced game in the Hunter the Reckoning series.
Oh, no.
Right? The version that was uploaded, it was dated from back in 2025. My understanding is that multiple outlets have contacted developer Taeon for comment. I don't believe any of the outlets got a meaningful response. We've had a couple of games based on this tabletop setting within World of Darkness over the years. The build that was uploaded was not finished. All the same, I think this is really exciting, especially for, you know, people who play mage, werewolf, vampire, etc. I don't know. This could be really interesting. I'm somewhat inclined to check it out if it turns out well. I know people were really happy with RoboCop Rogue City, so to hear that they're doing a game in the Hunter setting, I don't know. I'm tentatively excited, despite the obvious poor luck the poor studio had in this leak occurring.
Yeah, honestly, despite having played World of Darkness, or I guess technically Chronicles of Darkness games in the past, I was not really familiar with Hunter the Reckoning, but my understanding is it's like kind of monster hunting.
Yeah, that's my understanding.
Yeah, cool.
Excellent. Yeah, I've really enjoyed, obviously, you know, like vampire games and what have you, so I'll definitely be keeping my eyes on the in the direction of this one. This next story is a wild one. Basically, there has been a individual online using their company to file copyright claims to take down any online material at all relating to an obscure 90s Japanese PC game. The Video Game History Foundation has been basically trying to fight this for a while. The game is called Cookies Bustle. And basically, the Video Game History Foundation, they actually have a physical copy of this game in their possession. And then they made a page to display the physical copy that they have in their possession. And even their page got hit with a copyright strike. The good thing, of course, is that, you know, this guy targeting them, my understanding is that that is what kind of opened the door to start fighting back and ultimately freeing Cookies Bustle. This is a really interesting one. People are now saying that Cookies Bustle is, you know, free. It's not going to be taken down by this guy anymore. It's just kind of a weird story, but definitely one that is interesting and where it sounds like a right has been wronged. And as a fan of surreal entertainment, obviously I'm also delighted.
I just have to wonder what this person's deal with Cookies Bustle. Like, I have to imagine that it was like either a gift gone wrong, like a gift that they did not want, or like they wanted to play it at one point and it like ruined their life. Like,
yeah, right. Or like they gave a copy to someone they really liked and they were like, ew, Eggmania status.
Okay, but Eggmania actually was decent.
Girl, it was decent for what it was, but if someone seriously gave you a copy as like a romantic persuasion, it would be a negative.
Wait,
okay, maybe
so
not
that...
now for us. Maybe not now for us because we have such a like friendship meme about it. But in general, if someone gave you a copy of Eggmania, wouldn't you be a little offended?
I wouldn't be offended, but maybe that's why I've been single all these years.
Ah!
Need to stop giving Eggmania as a gift to would-be paramours.
All right, move us forward.
Yes, this is a very silly story. So this is from GamesRadar, who shared this. Apparently, Takfuji, who, if you aren't familiar with him, was from Extreme Hack and Slash title. Did it pick up the whisper?
Yorp.
So, you know, that Konami E3 event, I think it was 2010, right?
Yeah.
So he worked on, besides 99 Nights 2, he also worked on Frogger 3D, which was a 3DS revival of Frogger, the arcade game. So Fuji-san was posting on social media. I won't say the site because of reasons. How he found a copy in a Japanese gaming store for 19,800 yen. Which is about $125, but LOL, you know, global economy, who knows what it'll be by the time this episode goes up. And said, holy now, my title became collectible. Why I don't have a copy in my hand? And then someone responded to Fuji-san and said that the retro game market was ruined in the wake of COVID. Fuji-san responded that every price for everything gets ruined. How poignant in today's day and age.
Yeah. And, you know, I have to say that whole eco reuse factory complex where, you know, there's like a Hard Off and a Hobby Off and a bunch of other secondary stores in Japan is like just such a cool space. And so when I saw this picture, I was literally like, oh my God, I know the shop this is from.
Amazing.
Yeah. That having been said, this is a really fascinating story to me as someone who does spend a lot of time playing my own older games, you know, and who does recommend to others like playing older games that basically there's a lot of under the radar good or at least interesting games from that DS/3DS era where the good games, the ones that, you know, maybe didn't get mass produced like they should have or didn't stay in circulation as long as they should have or just have interesting details that make them worth checking up on, are all now skyrocketing in price. And I don't think that's a good thing. But, you know, I've been pretty clear on my opinions that I think artificial scarcity is a detrimental thing for the game space. I understand why these publishers want to keep us buying new products, but in a lot of instances, many of us would be happier continuing to play old games than just continuing to buy new games that we don't even necessarily like that much. And I think it's okay to play old games, even though obviously many of these publishers and advertisers want that sentiment to be a dirty word. They want us addicted to only the new hotness and constantly paying them money. But if you're happier playing the same Pokemon game or Frogger game or what have you game and, you know, playing it and playing it and playing it well, just do that. It's okay. And if you have a copy of 3DS Frogger, hook it up.
Nice.
All right. So I kind of alluded to this a little earlier, but we have a story here. This is that Capcom has set a new franchise sales record with Resident Evil Requiem. They sold in their first 5 days more than 5 million units. It is not a sales record all around for Capcom. They have been outpaced by some Monster Hunter games on that sales number, but it is a new record for Resident Evil, which how many games get to say that about their, what, ninth mainline iteration and what, like 20th iteration total? That's wild.
Good for them.
Yeah. We also got word, according to the official Suikoden the Anime website, that the adaptation of Suikoden 2's story is going to begin airing in October. We also got the announcement of a slate of voice actors for the various characters in the game. I know there are a lot of us Suikoden fans out there. I'm really looking forward to this anime, and I'm really, really hoping they swing for the fences with this one.
Excellent.
What do you got for us?
We had the Final Fantasy XIV Live Letter 91 recently. There was lots of information about Patch 7.5, Trial to the Heavens, which is coming on April 28th. And obviously, the way that the patch content rolls out over a period of months, not all of this is dropping right away, but some personal highlights were that the third and final entry in the Echoes of Vanadiel Alliance Raid series will be coming. That is Winders, the Third Walk. I really enjoyed the other one so far. A new area of the Occult Crescent, Northhorn, is coming. There will be an increase of knowledge level to 40 with new phantom jobs. I believe we've talked a little bit about our experiences there. I've enjoyed my time, even though it's a bit limited. There is going to be, maybe I'm one of few people who actually cares about this, but a new ocean fishing route. I love ocean fishing. It's going to include Thavnir, as well as, from the sounds of it, your island sanctuary area. That's amazing.
I also really like ocean fishing, so I know you're saying just you, but for me, this was also one of the highlights, and the fact that they're going to go by your island sanctuary area is so cool.
Yeah, I have to wonder, because I haven't had a chance to even dive into everything yet, like, does it mean that it's going to be phased so that, like, you can see yours, or is it just going to be parts of the island that are, like...
I'm not really sure. Like, the way they said it, it kind of sounded like we were all going to see our own, but I don't really know that for sure.
Even if it's just generically the island sanctuary, like, an area that is not customizable, I still think that's super cute. There will be a new planet for cosmic exploration. I have barely even touched the most recent one. Dang, I gotta get back to that. There's going to be multiplayer gold saucer modes. Like, come on, bestie, let's go sauce it up. I guess technically there already are some multiplayer things, but like, I am excited for the potential. And most importantly for some, Beastmaster, it is going to be the new limited job in the vein of the Blue Mage job. You'll be able to capture beasts and call upon them to fight at your side, using a one-handed axe as a weapon, a melee DPS roll starting at level 1 with a level cap of 50. You'll be able to tame up to 50 types of beasts, and up to 3 beasts can accompany you at one time. And you will fight with your beasts. And there's also promising to be a single player experience called the Crucible of the Unbroken. I would say it would be like the Masked Carnival of Blue Mage, but they describe it as unlike any previous content in Final Fantasy XIV so far. This is going to bring back the good vibes of playing Hunter in World of Warcraft. I can't wait. What about you? Are you excited about Beastmaster or any of these other things?
So, in theory, I'm excited for Beastmaster. It's the new limited job. I really like the old limited job, Blue Mage, a lot. But that actually gives me sort of my complex feelings. Alongside them talking about Beastmaster, they kind of made a joke about it. Like, I know you guys were looking forward to Blue Mage stuff, but we really prioritized Beastmaster, so now Blue Mage isn't getting an update this expansion. And they even were like, it's not getting an update in the 7.0 series, which means this expansion, but is, I think, a less definitive way of saying that. I understand there's only like 12 of us that really love that content, but as one of the 12, I'm kind of big mad. They showed a lot of stuff here. There was a lot of quality of life features that they discussed, many of which you didn't even highlight here, just because honestly, there were so many little details that they're sort of working on quality of life stuff. But from my perspective, I was so mad about them basically canceling this expansion's Blue Mage update that I was like, Squeenix is lucky they hold my account hostage with that private housing auto demolition timer, because this is take a break type shit. I'm big steamed hams over this. I don't know. Overall, I'm happy. Overall, a lot of this stuff sounds really cool. But hearing that content that I've been really looking forward to isn't coming this expansion cycle, despite repeated promises, is just like, fuck you, dude. Steamed hams.
You call them steamed hams, despite the fact that they are obviously grilled.
And then was there anything else in particular you wanted to highlight?
I mean, you did mention the quality of life things, like they're consolidating dies. That's kind of cool.
Yeah. I won't have to have a retainer just to be a die mule anymore.
Like me too.
Excellent. All right. Well, then we also have word here. This is of a new anime franchise collaboration. This is the ever popular Gundam franchise, this time collaborating with Apex Legends. I will note, I actually think this is a really cool collaboration in the sense that the actual skins are just straight up Gundam skins for the game's characters. I had been expecting that it would be like, oh, it's going to be, you know, this character in like cosplay somewhat reminiscent of a Gundam Wing. But no, it's just straight up, you're going to be a Gundam Wing with the power abilities of such and such character. Honestly, I think this is a really cool implementation of an anime IP crossover. It kind of makes me bummed that I did not play Apex beyond that first month or two, because I think this is really cool. Did you have any thoughts on that one, Slaggy?
Nope. Gundams are cool. Right.
We also have word then here that Let It Die is going to be ending service on September 1. I can understand why you might think then that this should be a doom and gloom story, but actually, something that's very cool is that Gung Ho Online, the publisher of the title, has announced that they are going to be relaunching the game as a paid offline edition this fall. Of course, the sequel, Let It Die Inferno, did launch on PS5 and PC last year. They have a second season of content just starting. The first Let It Die was a PS4 game and also on Steam. That actually released during the first Game Boy era, I think. I kind of remember a lot of our contemporaries from that moment in time talking about it anyway. So I think it's really cool. Initially, I was bummed about this. You know, we hear about games getting their online services ended and sunset, and we get bummed out. But transitioning into an offline edition and turning it into a regular release and like specifically removing like the micro transaction stuff and placing in normal game mechanics in those places, this is actually good. I think this is going to end up being a better version of Let It Die than the online release had been. This is literally stop killing games. Like, this is what we want. This is perfect. And I think this is just really cool. I was really, really happy about this announcement overall.
I am glad they're not going to let it die.
Yes.
All right. At GDC, as part of the GDC Awards, they recognized some veterans in the game industry. One was Don Daglow, who got the Lifetime Achievement Award, one of the original Intellivision game programmers at Mattel. Notably for us, as members of the LGBTQIA+ community, they have also honored Rebecca Heineman posthumously with the Ambassador Award. So I am just so glad that Rebecca is getting her flowers. Hugely impactful in the industry. And, you know, just for someone in the trans community to be getting honored and highlighted, I think is a great thing.
Absolutely.
In today's world.
Absolutely. And speaking of the GDC awards, we also have word here that Clair Obscur Expedition 33, which was, I think, one of our goatees last year, did win the Game of the Year award at the GDC Choice Awards. In addition to that, of course, it won an assortment of other awards, including but not limited to Best Narrative and Best Visual Art. It's been really nice to see this game getting so much love and respect. As a big fan of what they did from a gameplay and mechanics perspective, I'm really delighted. As a fan of what they did narratively, even though, again, as I've noted, I don't necessarily think they broke a ton of new ground. I do think they executed at an exceptionally high level, and I'm really just delighted to see that recognized. I hope that it results in more turn-based RPGs with high production values to come.
Yeah, it kind of swept the awards.
Indeed. Let's see, we also have, and this is a really fun one, this is word that after, for the last 7 years, LEGO has been making Mario Legos. And I know you don't say Legos. The plural of Lego is Lego bricks. I still casually say Legos. It is what it is. Basically, though, for a long time, the Mario Lego figure is like this weird, blocky, almost looks more like a Duplo oversized block because it has some electronics in it and it's like an interactive thing. We got the announcement that in the new 2027 Nintendo Lego sets, we are going to have proper minifigs of multiple Nintendo characters, including but not limited to Mario himself. This is, of course, really exciting for those of us who have wanted a Mario minifig for the last 7+ years. And if you don't, I don't know, get better hobbies.
Now, this new minifig is really cute. I thought the interactivity they had with these Lego sets to date have been very, very cute. But, you know, nice to see Mario in minifig form.
Big that. Yeah, exactly. And then we also had the announcement here. This is of a remake of The Seventh Guest, titled The Seventh Guest Remake.
Wow.
It is due out in later 2026. It'll be releasing on PS5, Xbox Series, and Switch, as well as PC via Steam and the Epic Games Store. It does look like a modern 3D real-time Seventh Guest remake. It's kind of all very does what it says on the tin, right? I have been interested in revisiting some of this era of the FMV mansion exploration type games. It was almost like a whole little subgenre there for a minute. That's really what Blueprints took me back to when I did check it out. It might be interesting to revisit Blueprints while playing alongside some of these types of games that, from my perspective, inspired it kind of. So maybe that's what I'll do later this year.
Yeah.
Excellent. All of this having been done, all of this having been said, I think we should go to Idaho.
You're living in your own private Idaho. Living in your own private Idaho.
All right. So Pokemon Pokopia is a game that people are playing. Many people, but I'll get to that in a minute. The Hoppip, Skiploom, and Jumpluff event is currently running and will last until March 24th, 2026. You're able to get items themed to these grass-type cuties and have them move into your Pokopia. They are very cute, and the items are cute. I have already done them. There's also a patch coming to fix some bugs that can interfere with progress, which is good. The biggest news here is that Pokopia has sold 2.2 million copies in its release weekend alone. So since then, probably even more. It is already one of the best-selling Pokemon spinoffs ever.
Yeah, honestly, it's been really wild. Like, we're seeing this Pokemon spinoff that is just doing these wild numbers, right? And then, in addition to that, we have it being literally, like, the best reviewed Pokemon game of all time. Like, even including the mainline games, it's honestly really something.
I think it deserves that.
I do too. Just really phenomenal player response here. And I think the word of mouth is kind of insane on this one. And we'll get to that. But I will say, for me, if you're listening to this episode and Pokopia is on your radar at all, Pokemon Pokopia, for me, it is a must play game. It is, for me, maybe the year's first must play.
Yep. Bowie Award candidate.
Indeed. All right, let's see. We also have word here of a fun cross-company collaboration, the type of which we sometimes see in these arcade port situations.
Yeah.
This is word that Bandai Namco is making a Resident Evil 2 remake arcade release. In Japan, this will be releasing as Biohazard RE2 Arcade. It is expected to be hitting Japanese arcades for location tests probably right around this time, because the press release said mid-March. The full versions should be releasing in Japan and Europe sometime this year. There hasn't been any indication yet of American arcades getting this, but I would be shocked if we didn't hear about either Dave and Buster's or, more likely, Round One getting some kind of exclusive deal for U.S. distribution when the final version rolls out.
Definitely.
Let's see. We also have word here. This is coming out of Arc System Works. This is their new card-based survival game, Goriratare. I don't even know what to say about that. It is literally like a solitaire card game type setup that is centered around building a troop of gorillas. I will probably check this out as an Arc System Works fan and a fan of card games and someone who enjoys survival games. This ticks a lot of boxes for me on paper, but it's just such a weird proposition. It's going to be launching on PS5, 4, Switch, PC, via Steam, iOS, Android next week. So on March 18th, possibly by the time you're listening to this episode. But definitely a weird one that I'm going to check out.
Yeah, I'm willing to bet they're probably trying to capitalize on Balatro's popularity. But the title Goriratare just makes me think of Saliti Horse.
All right. Let's see.
Which was another solitaire game.
Yeah, yeah. Funny enough. We then also have word here. This is of the Bravely Default Flying Fairy HD remaster getting a shadow drop on PC/Steam, as well as Xbox Series and the Microsoft Store. This is, of course, the iteration of the game first launched on Switch 2 on June 5th, 2025. I do not know why there is not also a PlayStation 5 port. That seems super weird to me. That having been said, I think the big Game Buoy perspective on this news is that this is the first time that this original Bravely Default game has ever been made available on non-Nintendo hardware. And, you know, although I am a Nintendo fanboy, I have also made it very clear that I think third-party games are better off not being exclusive. So I'm hella happy that a wider audience will now have access to what I think is a really great throwback RPG. I'd like to see PlayStation 5 owners get access to this title as well, frankly. Did you have any thoughts on that one?
I think that's great.
Excellent. Then what do you got for us?
So this is an interesting one, courtesy of Games Radar. There apparently was a bug in the original Fire Red Leaf Green, talking about Pokemon, of course, where, you know, the legendary dogs, or I guess they called them legendary beasts, because Raikou is kind of technically more of a cat, right? I guess Entei as well. But that being said, you know, after you beat the game, they will roam around Kanto, and but there was a bug with Raikou and Entei, who if they used Roar, there was a possibility that they could disappear forever and not spawn again. Thankfully, this has been fixed in the Switch re-releases, so thank goodness. I mean, I don't know why you wouldn't want to get Suicune instead, but, you know, maybe you chose a different starter.
This is one of those things where, like, I had heard about it in the past and, like, was, like, deathly afraid of ever running into this. Again, this just sort of goes in hand with what we had talked about last week that, you know, for this fire red, leaf green port, they really made a lot of quality of life changes sort of under the hood that really make it a much better release than it has been in the past.
For sure.
Excellent. All right, well then let's keep this show moving. We've got word here that longtime Nintendo director Goro Abe, probably most known particularly among Western fans as the director of WarioWare, is leaving Nintendo after 25 years.
Wow.
More than 25 years. He will be taking up a professorial role at Osaka Electrocommunication University. I think, you know, if you're going to be leaving Nintendo for anything, the fact that he is going to be a professor in their newly established game and social design department is probably a pretty good move. His final directorial effort was the Move It iteration of WarioWare that came a couple of years ago. Really interesting. You know, we've talked in the past about the changing of the guard we're seeing at Nintendo, and this is kind of just another piece of it. Just very interesting times.
Yeah, good for him for inspiring and teaching the next generation.
Indeed. And then last in this segment, but certainly not least, we have word that Shinji Mikami is forming a new studio. You may, of course, recall that Shinji Mikami has formed a few studios over the years. He was linked to the studio Kamui that was listed under the Shadows of the Damned remaster, for example. This new AAA studio, Unbound, apparently they've actually been sort of working under the radar for years. They apparently have about 50 staff members and plan to grow to 150. They've indicated that, you know, they're working on AAA quality, AA content, and that they're right now, you know, working on original IP. So fingers crossed that things go well for them. It is a scary time to be doing any type of independent company, but frankly, it is what we need more of. So I really hope things go well for them.
Same here.
All right. All of that having been done and said, it is time to move on to So Controversial.
Controversial.
Oh my god. All right, so this first one is really interesting, and I feel like we are going to be getting more information as this story develops. So two Japanese Final Fantasy 14 news blogs have shut down recently. The first one was per Square Enix filing a request. This is the blog called Netoge Sokuho, formerly known as Final Fantasy FF14 Sokuho. Square Enix claims that the blog published an article containing harmful content that undermined the social reputation of the MMO's devs. And Square Enix also said that it will continue to stake strict measures, including legal action if needed, to protect the safety of its employees and their mental health. It is unclear what the contents of the post were, but the fact that they were mentioning employees' safety and mental health makes me feel it was something more than just criticism of the game. Like, I hope this isn't just a case of Square Enix trying to censor free speech. I don't get that impression based on the way that they phrased the measures they would take to protect their employees. As a result of this, the blog Umadori Sokuho has also gone offline, but this is apparently due to the admin's own decision rather than anything Square Enix did. I guess just based on, you know, not wanting to get censured, basically. I don't know. So this is just this is an interesting one. And there's, like, at this point, we don't seem to have, like, internet archive of the original post. So we really don't know what was said. This one is interesting.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I feel like we're seeing an increase in personal attacks and toxicity in the Japanese social media space. I know Nagoshi-san, formerly of Ryu Gagatoku Studio, he had tweeted earlier this month and then promptly deleted a tweet. It said, "I understand that you are upset on what is going on in my former company, but please don't use my name to attack my friends. I find it very uncomfortable." This was with regard to some of the controversial stuff that had been going on with regard to Yakuza 3's remake that we talked about last
episode. Right.
There was a lot of going on in the Japanese side of things about, like, Nagoshi-san would never let this happen. And, you know, really using Nagoshi's name as a way to attack others. So I think we're really, and again, to the point that Nagoshi-san ended up deleting even this very pleasant plea. I thought it was perfectly reasonable what Nagoshi asked for, and yet he ultimately deleted the tweet. So there's a weird strain of toxicity in the net space. Obviously, I don't really know if it's related to the same strain of toxicity in the Western gamer space, but definitely a strain of toxicity. And seeing this Final Fantasy 14 situation where, you know, there's been two different blogs now shut down makes me wonder if it isn't related to kind of this same toxicity.
Yeah, I mean, especially with Dawn Trail, like, I know how people on the web in English language social media have been toxic in some ways about the game. So I have to wonder what it was like. I will be interested to see if we get more insight to this, because I'm wanting to say that I am on Square Enix's side here, tentatively. If people are, like, saying things,
yeah,
like, I mean, because it could be, like, death threats. I mean, like, which sounds ridiculous, but, I mean, we've talked about it on the show.
Or citing specific development staff members and, like, targeting them or talking derisively about them in inappropriate ways. You know, if it is just an individual being a little critical, I do not support that. But if it is an individual being harassing, being really rude, being really inappropriate, that's not right. People shouldn't be like that.
Yeah.
It's kind of like the Nagoshi thing. Like, keep my name out of your mouth if you're going to behave that way, is basically what he said.
Game devs are people too. And people do not seem to remember that sometimes.
Like, you see it a lot with, like, the Platinum Games Hideki Kamiya tweeting situation. I understand that he's very acerbic and somewhat combative, but, like, he's getting tweeted at by thousands of people every day, many of them being hella rude. Like, yeah, of course he blocks people first thing. He's being spammed and inundated with people being freaking scum to him. And then we have everybody like, well, he blocked me and I was just making a milquetoast joke. It's like, yeah, he doesn't have the time to be that nuanced. He's also trying to make art that we all consume. Like, get off his back. Damn. Game developers are people too. We need to stop treating them like exploitable resources. We should not be behaving like the corporate overlords. It's a bad thing.
And speaking of corporate overlords treating people like resources, but the gamers are the resources here, right?
Here we go. This is Word, and I'm going to read Kotaku's headline because they underline the fucking audacity of it. This headline is, Fortnite raising V-Buck prices and cutting back bonus rewards, quote, to help pay the bills, end quote. And then, of course, the lead notes that Epic is also lowering prices on Fortnite's various premium battle passes, which gives them the right, or not the right, but the ability to say, well, we're also reducing the prices. I've seen a lot of the Fortnite defense force falling back on that exact defense. So it's like a very clear manipulation. Basically, starting March 19th, players are going to get fewer V-Bucks anytime they buy in-game premium currency. Right now, the $9 pack gets you 1,000 V-Bucks, and after the 19th, $9 is going to get you 800 V-Bucks. This means that the price of digital goods, like songs for use in festival, for example, are inflating. Right now, for the $9 pack, you can get 2 songs. After this change, you will only be able to get 1 song, and you'll, you know, have to get additional V-Bucks to get a second song. It's also, well, it's also worth noting, you know, Epic had added a way to buy the exact amount of V-Bucks you need in increments of 50. Previously, it used to be 50 cents to get 50 V-Bucks this way. Now it's going to cost $1. Which also means that if you do a fill-in this way on, like, songs, they're going to end up costing you several dollars more per song. Definitely seems really skeezy. They did lower the price of the passes by 200 V-Bucks each, but they also removed the bonus V-Bucks on the passes, so they'll be a lot less self-sustaining than they used to be. It's all just really scummy, and the fact that Epic, knowing that they make crazy money and they're involved in so many, they have their hands in so many different pies, claiming that they're exploiting their user base to help pay the bills and that this is due to, like, increased costs and what have you, considering it literally just came literally like a day after Epic wrapped up that big legal battle, I don't know. My expectation based on their victory would have been for prices to be going down on V-Bucks. Now I'm like, are you subsidizing your lawyer costs by raising fees? Like, what is going on here?
I mean, you also have to wonder how many people stopped playing and stopped their Fortnite crews and stopped buying V-Bucks. Like, I know I did, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. It could be a reflection that they have taken a real hit. I know both of us were long-time subscribers who thought we would be subscribed in perpetuity, who fucking cut off the faucet and haven't reopened it.
Yeah, I haven't even played Fortnite since then.
Same. I logged into the web Epic store to spend V-Bucks I already had on a song for festival in case I do come back. But, like, I haven't logged into the game proper since before Winterfest.
Yep.
Damn, and I used to be a daily login, like, without fail. Crazy times.
Yep.
So resulting in this kerfuffle, the shrinkflation on virtual currency, as Kotaku insightfully points it out, basically there has been a response in the fan base of encouraging people to boycott Fortnite. They are trying to do right now a targeted boycott on March 19th. Hopefully we'll have this episode uploaded before March 19th so that anyone who is a listener and still playing can at least sit out that day. But, you know, as we noted, we've skipped out altogether. We're both happier for it. I don't know. It's funny because one of the developers was talking about how the current player response, how a lot of people say, you know, the item shop is the main focus instead of the game. They're talking about how, like, oh, it hits them really hard. It's not the impression they want to give, nor is it, really reflective of their focus. But, I mean, honestly, it really does feel that way. It really feels like all the focus is on the IPs and the crossovers rather than the gameplay. And I've been pretty clear. I think my favorite is when the gameplay and the crossovers feed into each other. Stuff like when we got them playing with the huge sense of scale with the playable Megazord mode. I don't know. I think that they can do really good stuff. But this past season, this has not felt that way to me. Which, as noted, we're on a boycott, soft boycott here in studio. So anyway, if you're playing Fortnite and you are hearing this before the 19th, stop playing Fortnite at least for the 19th. And broadly, maybe consider a different game.
Yeah, I believe that's the first day of the prices being increased. Which I think is also the first day of the new season is what it sounds like.
Interesting.
The graphic that's circulating on social media says our goal, lower the player count on the first day of the new season.
Ah, that does make sense. And honestly, I do think that denying Epic their headline about, you know, more concurrent players than ever before is the correct approach, because obviously that's what Epic is trying to aim for with every new season launch. And the player base being coordinated to deny them that is a positive, in my opinion. So we support this. We think that, again, you know, it's worth standing up, putting your feet down, and really committing when you believe in something. And I do believe that this shrinkflation on digital goods is BS. So I hope the fans ultimately are heard.
Indeed.
Let's see. We also have word here, and this is honestly exciting. This is word that Ark Raiders, the massive PC hit, has started to replace the in-game voices that had been previously generated with AI with new human recorded ones. So that's obviously a huge positive. It's a very good thing. The funny thing is that the publisher's CEO, the CEO at Embark Studios, Patrick Soderlund, he had previously indicated that, like, oh, AI is the best way to get voices. But he did acknowledge in this announcement that the real voices are better, that there is a quality difference. And the real quote, or the full quote, even says something like, a real professional actor is better than AI. That's just how it is. So I actually really appreciate that. I have noted, you know, I do not play these games while they still have the AI stuff in them. I've heard a lot about Ark Raiders. I am obviously interested in it. If they ever get to a zero AI voice state, I will check it out.
Yeah.
I hope they continue fueling the fire.
Absolutely.
What do you got for us?
Yeah, so this one is a real doozy. This is another great article from Aftermath. Go support them, because I want you to support Aftermath. I'm just going to give you the basics. The headline is, "The Secretive Company Filling Video Game Sites with Gambling in AI." So basically, it is a great piece of investigative journalism, as, you know, that's kind of Aftermath's thing, that in, like, you know, personal interest stories and stuff. This is by Jackson Ryan on Aftermath. Basically, there is this company called Clickout Media, which owns sites including The Escapist, which used to be a legitimate site, if I recall, but who knows? My memory could be failing me, but The Escapist used to be legit, right?
Yeah, absolutely. But now they had Yahtzee for a long time.
Yeah. And,
you know, but this really kind of goes hand in hand with, you know, how we've talked about some of these SEO sites really buying out known reputable names in order to launder their reputations. And it sounds like that's exactly what's happening.
Yeah. So these websites have started to become littered with gambling and casino stories and AI content. And this extends to, like, straight up fake AI authors with, like, periodically changing social media icons that, like, are supposed to be the same person, but it's like, no, that person has a different mouth, or, like, you know, their face shape is different. Like, not only that, but apparently, like, actual real humans' work is being edited to include links to the online gambling and casino articles. Like, what the fuck?
Yeah. Again, this is just one of those things that is just really important to be aware of. We've talked a little bit about the attention economy and how really right now human thought and focus is under fire. And this is, you know, just another way. They're literally buying websites that you know and trust in order to under the cut kind of basically propagandize to you about this, you know, Gen AI, get your clicks, feed you ads for gambling sites and start normalizing that to you. It's again, just one of those things that just open your eyes and be aware of it if you're in this space, because we factually know that gamers are a target audience for manipulation. And unfortunately, we have been for many years, apparently.
Yep, I just loaded up one of their sites, Games Hub, to see, and it literally says, games and gambling news, guides, and reviews. It's like, wow. Ahoy, babies, welcome to Games Hub, your port of call for games and gambling news, guides, and reviews. And there's, like, literally, at first you see, like, Crimson Desert, Zelda, and then you scroll down a little bit, and it's Coin Poker. There's a big ad for Coin Poker and latest slot game reviews.
Wow.
And some... one of the reviewers is one of the AI reviewers.
Naturally. Yeah. Be aware. Just keep your eyes open. Be aware. And, you know, this is why we buoy stuff like this, right? It's not that we're obsessed with negativity or whatever. It's just like there's great value in being aware of who's trying to inform you. And that's literally one of our goals here, is like trying to buoy the good information and the notices of bad information.
Yeah, because, like, there are straight-up fake games journos putting out gambling slop.
Yeah. Here's an interesting one, and kind of follows, again, in some of the broad anti-capitalist themes that seem to be cropping up in this episode, even though that's really not our episode theme this week. This one, however, is word that Pokemon Pokopia was overpriced on Amazon, seemingly directly due to the physical edition being out of print at many retailers, as was reported by IGN, Kotaku, and several other news sites. The Amazon price for the game key card for Pokemon Pokopia was price raised from $69.99, which is the manufacturer's suggested retail, up to $79.99. That's not a good thing at all. I'm really at a loss for words over this, right? Like, retailers in theory are supposed to be the place you can go to get things for the manufacturer's suggested price. Them acting more like a scalper to me is a very fearful thing, particularly as Amazon works increasingly hard to be the only place you can buy physical things from. That's obviously not something I'm super pleased about, and them exploiting their customers that they already charge subscription fees, that they're constantly increasing their prices for various quality of life services on. F Amazon, basically. Do you have anything to add?
Well, you know, I just looked, and currently it is $69.99.
Yay!
I have to wonder if what happened, and obviously I have not explored this story deeply, but maybe it was just that they were like the third-party sellers, or maybe not.
That was my original thought too, but I've seen multiple reputable sites saying that it was the ones that were still saying from Amazon, so I don't know.
Yeah, and I'm rereading this article, and it does look like that was that they mentioned that. So I wouldn't have expected Kotaku to not be looking into that.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, Amazon probably was doing it for as long as they could get away with it, and then as soon as it started getting called out, they probably changed it and lied and were like, we didn't do that.
I would recommend, if you bought a physical copy of Pokopia and you paid $80, call up Amazon and complain. I do not order stuff from them anymore, but I know in the past when things have been messed up, I have called and respectfully complained about my dissatisfaction, and they like to hand out free courtesy credits to keep their customers happy. So you know, if you did do that, maybe try to squeeze some money out of them.
Yeah, if you got ripped off, absolutely put their feet to the fire. If they're acting like a scalper out here, they deserve it.
Especially if, like, you're a Prime member, like, tell them you're going to cancel your Prime and that you're dissatisfied. Stick it to them. This one is really upsetting. So just a few days ago, we had Ben Diskin, who was the voice of Mega Man in Mega Man 11, announced that he's no longer the voice of Mega Man and will not be reprising his role in the upcoming Mega Man game, Dual Override. What we then found out is that SAG-AFTRA... Did I say that right? SAG-AFTRA, yeah.
So no, I get you, though.
They issued a do not work order against Capcom for failing to initiate the signatory process. Basically, what Ben Diskin thinks is that Capcom might be trying to get around AI protections that they would have to provide to union workers. So not a fan of this.
Yeah, we're going to have to see how things play out, since technically this game still does not exist yet. None of the recording has happened. But on the face of it, it's going to be really hard for me to engage with this game if they're choosing not to work with union actors in a traditionally union-dictated space. I don't like this at all, and to see this happening to Mega Man, of all things, is definitely a real, real sore spot for me.
Yeah, especially when so many of us were excited about this.
Indeed. And then last, but certainly not least...
Oh my god!
Right? This is word of a new game in the vein of PAL World, by which I mean a shameless Pokemon ripoff. This one is Pikmon.
Excuse me? Pikmon?
And the thing about Pikmon is that, you know, there were a lot of the monster designs in PAL World that clearly looked like Pokemon, but slightly changed. The thing is, in Pikmon, it's even more egregious. Like, it straight up just looks like the trainer is riding a Charizard and has a Lucario. And has, like, a little bear who I forgot his name.
I know who you're talking about. Ursaring?
Yeah, okay. And it's, like, and it's just such a blatant ripoff. It's really wild. Pomo. That looks like little Pomo.
Yeah. Yeah, so, like, I was watching this trailer, and I swear, I was like, that's straight up Breloom, the one that's, like, got a little mushroom for a head, except that they had the mushroom had, like, red with white spots, but, like, otherwise the character design was identical. There's one that looks like a Lapras, and then on top of that there's, like, a rival that you are fighting against in this trailer that's, like, legitimately Roadhog from Overwatch.
Yeah, no, it's very we have Pokemon and PAL World at home.
And then it's, like, the characters, like, Link from Breath of the Wild.
Yeah. Oh, no, it's a real nasty work. I'm not a big fan of these types of clones, really. You know, when you do your own designs and you do your own art assets and you do your own spin on it, I think that's fine. Clones and being inspired by other stuff on the market has been happening since literally the beginning. But straight up ripping off someone else's shit, that sucks. And I understand, I guess, the difference here is that you capture your monsters in... playing cards or trading cards rather than, you know, Pokeballs or whatever. But, like, come on now. That's not the thing that makes Pokemon Pokemon.
Right.
Just very disappointing.
Someone in the comments, and usually, you know, reading the comments is questionable, but said that this looks a lot like an AI trailer that was designed specifically to try to scam people out of their money from pre-orders and then cut and run.
I'd believe it. All right, with all of this having been done and all of this having been said, let us talk about some downer news in
Doom and Gloom.
Doom and Gloom.
Yeah.
So the first Doom and Gloom is jobs being cut at a studio. Unfortunately, not surprising. This is the Australia-based mobile studio Halfbrick. They have cut 41 roles and ended a number of engagements internationally. You may know Halfbrick from their latest title, Bluey's Quest for the Gold Pen, which was released on iOS and Android this winter and has console versions coming in May. I'm being a little silly there with the Bluey thing, but yeah, this sucks for the 41 people affected.
Absolutely. We also have word here that Tripwire Interactive, you're probably most familiar with them for their work on the Killing Floor games. They have laid off 23 employees. This is per a statement on LinkedIn where the Georgia-based studio said it, quote unquote, needs to align with business realities where needed in order to stay focused on creative goals as the gaming industry continues to evolve. Obviously, this really sucks. We hope that everyone whose jobs were negatively impacted bounce back without too much interruption to their life. And while we're at it, unfortunately, perennial punching bags in the gaming space over the last year, Build a Rocket Boy, have laid off additional staff, as in a statement, the CEO, Mark Gerhard, once again alleged corporate espionage involving their game. I haven't seen enough to suggest actual corporate espionage. We've talked about Build a Rocket Boy's big game Mind's Eye a fair bit during the modern era of Game Buoy, to the degree, Slaggy, that you even bought that game, right?
I did. I own a copy of it.
Yeah, so I don't think the corporate espionage was happening. I certainly haven't seen anything that they have alleged. That having been said, I sincerely, truly, and deeply hope that everyone negatively impacted by what's happening over at Build a Rocket Boy, I hope everyone lands on their feet, and I hope that they all come out of this okay.
I can't wait for someday getting a investigative journalism piece on this whole Mind's Eye saga, because like
I need the tell-all, yeah.
Something's not right here.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, well, today we do have a smash hit for you, so we are going to change gears, and rather than talk about something that we're pretty bummed about, we're going to talk about an article we're pretty excited about and we think is worth checking out. So let's give it to you. Smash hit.
Smash hit.
All right, I want to link you to a piece over on Aftermath. I'll link you over at GameBuoy.org.
Over at GameBuoy.org.
This is an article. It's not tied to any specific game. This is an article. It's titled Great Journalism Doesn't Happen Overnight. And it's actually, I call it an article, but it's really a transcription, a podcast and a transcription of a podcast wherein they talk about the work and the effort that went into this. Because I read faster than I hear, I did read it and I think of it as an article. It occurs to me that since we are a podcast, probably I should encourage you all to listen to this. That having been said, this was really insightful and, how do I say this correctly? Educational, I think, is the correct way. Like, it just really informed me. Like, this is one of those things where, for example, the report on ClickOut that Slaggy was talking about a few minutes ago, that was apparently 8 months in the making on Aftermath's side. This whole idea, great journalism doesn't happen overnight, is basically that, you know, for those of us who want this kind of work to be done, and I say those of us because we here on the show certainly do, you have to support the work. You have to show up for it. You have to, you know, click the links. You have to watch the shows. You have to, you know, subscribe when they're doing their subscription drive, what have you. if what you want is high quality reporting that is being done in the service of the reader, then you, the reader, have to be making sure that that you're the primary shot caller, right? Not some CEO higher up who is going to be pulling the strings and controlling the bylines. Like, I mean, I know we talk every week at the end of our show that if you like what independent sites like Aftermath are doing, that you should subscribe to them. And certainly I have to think that's probably part of the motive behind pushing this podcast on their part. But again, 8 months of investigative journalism they did on Aftermath in order to report on something that we should all know about, this shadowy entity buying up known names and using them to launder negative content. That's important. It's important that people are doing this work, and it's important to support this work if you're benefiting from it. So if you are a fan of Aftermath, like we are, we do encourage you to sign up and support them. If you're a fan of good investigative journalism within the games space, I really think you should read this. Listen to this podcast, not read this article, and check it out.
Indeed.
With all of that having been said, then, let's move over to your place for gossip, rumor mongering, and all other manner of hearsay with Rumor Has It.
Rumor has it. Rumor has it. Rumor has it. Rumor has it.
Ooh, this one's a doozy, and I know I said that about another thing earlier, but this one is a doozy. So, there has been a long-running investigation by the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States. This began under the previous administration, and this is centering on Tencent. There are concerns about the access that Tencent may have to the data of millions of American players due to their stakes in multiple companies, including Epic Games and fully owning Riot, just to mention a few. You know, they also have minority stakes in Ubisoft, Remedy, Paradox, Krafton, Supercell, Funcom. So, like, these are names we hear a lot, right?
Absolutely.
You know, this seems very much in line with the concerns expressed about TikTok and the Chinese government, or, like, you know, Chinese businesses having access to our data. And we know how that turned out. So kind of makes me wonder if this is just setting things up for private equity firms to buy out the stakes that Tencent owns in these companies.
Private equity firms or, you know, buddy cronies.
Same thing, right? Or other foreign interests. Don't you love late stage capitalism?
Love. No, hate.
Hate. I don't hate this rumor that you have, though, unless you wanted to say something about the investigation.
No. I think I made my feelings clear, as clear as I feel comfortable making them on that news story.
Yep.
We have word here that Nintendo may have leaked a new Mario World update. Of course, people had been hoping that this update would be coming for the Mario Day. I don't believe that came to pass. You know, that was March 10th. We do that every year. However, there have been screenshots on a now deleted post that Nintendo had posted that seemed to show new/different icons on several of the menus in game for Mario Kart World. Hence, it seems like Mario Kart World may well be getting a new update that adds several versus modes from previous games that had been missing in this iteration, including, yes, but hopefully not limited to, Coin Runners, Balloon Battle, Bob-omb Blast, you know, and having a little bit of everything that's already there and new stuff.
Yes, bring back Bob-omb Blast.
We need it. Absolutely. Okay, well then, All of that having been done, all of this having been said, that brings our news portion of the show to a conclusion. Let's move on to our discussion conversation with Designing Women, Interior Design in Games. All right, let's do this. This is a little bit of a tough conversation to start. We're not really trying to do the history of interior design in games for a lot of reasons, actually. kind of chief among them is that I'm of the belief that we're still seeing this idea translated into a game concept as recently as a major publisher release from this month. But also because I actually think the earliest roots of interior design in electronic games isn't even actually in electronic games. I think in a lot of ways, interior design as a game element really has its roots in productivity software and in folks using that software, obviously including but not limited to folks from the neurodivergent community, kind of finding the fun in playing with productivity software as a hobby from there, you know, a sort of design as play, if you will.
Absolutely.
So then that having been said, right, from my own perspective, you can also look at kind of like the strategy and simulation genres to see how the concept of design and layouts sort of came to start being gamified. I think obviously a lot of people have Warcraft 1 and 2 memories and Starcraft memories and like really learning and thinking about like building placement for the first time in those games. For me, you know, I think back to my first experiences in my elementary school's Mac lab with like SimCity and SimEarth and SimAnt, right? As kind of getting me interested in these electronic games with sort of what I think of as like, or at least thought of at the time as like non-traditional goals, right? I mean, it's a little more traditional now in the sense that these games are a lot more established now. But I also, you know, even back in the day, we really started to see design elements pop up in other genres to certain degrees, with RPGs obviously being an early forerunner. And to some degrees, we're talking about that, you know, we can say there are design elements in some of, you know, the SNES era JRPGs, and you can say, you know, interior design and housing elements comes up in more Western 360 era RPGs. So it's really kind of been a progression, right? For me, the first game that really comes to mind wherein I firsthand engaged really meaningfully with interior design gameplay elements was actually the 2004 PC MMO City of Heroes.
Yeah.
So there was a team-based slash headquarters mechanic, right, that you could have for like your in-game alliance or whatever. And I was actually recruited by a mutual on LiveJournal at the time for my quote-unquote stylistic sensibility to help them get their house in order, so to speak. This person actually paid for my sub and bought me the game, so I ended up really like treating it like a job rather than as a hobby I enjoyed. And I do actually kind of wonder if that isn't part of why I kind of bounced off of these kinds of games back in the day. I've also talked kind of how I bounced off of the GameCube version of Animal Crossing pretty hard. We'll get to this a little bit later, but it really wasn't until more recent years that I've really found where the fun is for me in these types of games. That having been said, then I'd like to ask you, what is the first game you recall playing that featured interior design as a gameplay element? And, you know, did you enjoy it at the time? How has your perspective of that game, those gameplay elements, has it changed or has it, you know, stayed the same? Where are you at?
So technically it would be The Sims, but, you know, it's funny you mentioned neurodivergent folks using productivity software. I spent what probably was literally hundreds of hours as a child on Windows 95, or it might have even been Windows 3.1 at some points, using like home design software and designing floor plans for houses. I tried to do some searching, and I think it might have been the program by Expert Software called Home Design 3D. It was a 1996 release for CD-ROM, which was compatible with Windows 95 and Windows 3.1. So, like, I feel like that was possibly it. I always, as a child, loved looking at, like, you know, like, if there were, like, open houses in the area, like, picking up a little brochure that had the floor plan on it. Like, I, to this day, still love a little floor plan with, like, here's the living room, and here's a little square that represents the sink, right? Like, something about it just really tickled my fancy. But what I was doing with this wasn't like, oh, I'm going to pursue architecture or even interior design. I was like, oh, I am going to design, this is going to be Knuckles' summer home, or like, you know,
because
I had this whole, I don't know if I've talked about this before, I had this whole like fan in AU where Sonic and his friends were in a rock band, because they, I used the Sonic Boom CD soundtrack as like that was their like album. And so, like, I straight up was like, oh, yeah, like, Sonic's obviously on guitar. And it was, like, the Saturday morning Sonic characters. Like, they all had, like, different roles in the band. So, like, I'd be like, yeah, so this is, like, Sally's Royal Retreat. And, like, I just would make these, like, home layouts for them. So, like, I know it sounds silly, but, like, honestly, like, that was where the appeal of, like, imagining a housing space and, like, thinking of the furniture, especially when you're a kid with, like, just, you know, straight up, like, twin-size bed, and you're like, oh, look, there's this, like, queen-size bed. So, like, ooh, Sally's a princess, so she's gonna have a queen-size bed, right? Like, I want to say that, like, I don't even think that my computer would have been able to run, like, the 3D elements. So, like, for me, it was literally just placing the furniture inside of the floor plans, like, legit.
Yeah, I love that.
I mean,
like, my dad's friend when I was growing up had that kind of software, and I would also play with it. So, like, I totally understand.
Oh, my God, I'm glad I'm not the only one.
No, you're really not.
But the thing is, I think anytime I see gameplay elements like this, it always kind of goes back to, you know, that thing. And I think also, not to get even beyond computer software, but, like, I think it honestly, especially for, like, you know, a little gay boy, like, kind of was like, oh, well, you know, almost like dollhouse adjacent, like that of imaginative play and creating a space that, you know, like, and I was thankful to be raised in a pretty gender role free household where, like, I wasn't like, oh, you can't play with dolls, that's not for a man, you know, like, I was very fortunate to have that upbringing. But I have to wonder how many other little gays out there, like, you know, found these sorts of games kind of fulfilling, like, their doll fantasy. Like, I know, we're going to talk about The Sims, but, like, Trixie Mattel, the well-known drag queen, like, she used to stream The Sims, and I feel like she has said, like, that, you know, because she, of course, she's, like, has a huge doll collection now, but I have to wonder if Trixie's love of The Sims is related to, you know, like, not being able to have a doll because her homophobic stepfather or whatever called her a Trixie. So,
well, okay, let's dig in on exactly that then, right? For years, The Sims was most folks' entry point into this genre, I think. Although the primary games, right, they were released in their fully featured form on PC only, you know, we did get console ports to keep growing the brand and spin-offs like The Herbs. My sense of classic Sims, at least before, like, maybe Sims 3 or Sims 4, was that the player base was kind of viewed as, like, kind of fanatical. I believe you have spent some time in that fandom, so I would love to hear about your experiences with the game, as well as any anecdotes you might have about that community.
So, I don't think I would say that I was, like, active in the Sims community. One of my really dearest longtime friends, she was a pretty serious Sims player, like, not like an influencer. Or Simfluencer, is that what they call them, do you think? Simfluencers? They must, right? But, you know, it's funny to think of this because I really haven't played a Sims game in probably like 10 years, but I have played all of the mainline Sims games. Sims 4, I did not play as much, and I think that's kind of where I just moved on to other things. And, you know, I would say that, technically speaking, the point of The Sims is the life simulation part, right? And, like, you know, navigating your sim through relationships and families and stuff. And obviously, like, I'm always going to stan Bella Goth and all the other silly storylines. Like, you know how she, like, in The Sims 2 seemingly got abducted by aliens and disappeared? Like, Sims lore is, like, wild. And I hope the movie really, like, plays on that. But the point of this is that, like, technically, I feel like that's really the focus. But for me, like, I was really more drawn to the interior design. Like, definitely with Sims 1 and probably Sims 2, to a lesser degree Sims 3, I, you know, would play as a Sim and, you know, make them interact. Like, I was one of the ones during the Sims 1 days to be like, oh, I can figure out how to make them gay, or, you know, like, two men living together. But really, I just wanted to build custom homes and decorate them. Like, I would spend so much time in the build menu, and it's not just because of the banger jazz soundtrack in that original Sims game in the build mode. Like, I just love looking at, like, all the different furnishing options and, like, you know, oh, here's the different exteriors you can have, and, like, oh, I'm going to put a, you know, Palm Springs style building on this lot, where it's, like, you know, kind of got, like, the, like, U-shaped building with, like, a swimming pool in the courtyard. Like, for me, like, that was really my draw for The Sims. And, like, you know, The Sims, like, there's a lot of mods and stuff out there. Like, the modding community in The Sims is actually pretty robust from my understanding of it, but, like, the most I ever did was, like, do the money cheats. You know how you could get, like, unlimited simoleons, which is the Sims money. So, I mean, I guess I am a bit of a Sims nerd because I know that they're called simoleons. I think that really speaks to my preference of more of, like, sandbox type modes for games like these. Just being able to create without having really any constraints of, like, end goals, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's not exclusive. I mean, I do enjoy story elements and, like, some of the types of games we're going to be talking about today, but, like, for me, I just wanted to create, and I loved that The Sims allowed me to do that. So I, as I said, wasn't ever really active in the community, but this isn't really related to, like, mods or, like, custom housing objects, but do you remember the 100 Baby Challenge? I think it was on BuzzFeed, like,
no.
A BuzzFeed creator. So the 100 Baby Challenge, and it, because it's kind of adjacent to, like, you know, a living space and interior design, because the challenge was to have one mother Sim who had 100 babies in one household.
Oh, my God.
And funny enough, the content creator who, like, again, I'm pretty sure it was off of BuzzFeed, who was known for this, she was a judge on the short-lived Sims reality competition show. Do you remember that?
Oh, wow. I do not.
I think it was during the pandemic, it might have been produced before that, but I'm pretty sure it aired in 2020. It was on TBS, and it was, like, where Sims...
The Sims sparked.
Yes, and they were, like, given challenges, and then, like, one team member was, like, the builder who had to build the houses. The other was the storyteller. So, like, honestly, like, I identify with those builders. Like,
wow.
I probably would not have been able to be on The Sims Sparked because It's not like I'm a pro level Sims builder, but it just shows you that there are people out there who are into that. You know, something that I did want to point out before we move on is, you know, there were always expansions over the years, but it seems like, especially with Sims 4, there's just been, like, content bloat. Like, Sims 1 only had 7 expansions. So far, Sims 4 has had 21. And that's not even counting, like, the content packs. Like, remember Katy Perry's Sweet Stuff content pack for The Sims? Like, so, you know, like, you could buy, like, cute candy furniture and clothes, too. But, like, obviously, like, I am guilty of microtransactions, right? But I feel like, you know, The Sims ecosystem has just kind of gotten really bloated. And, I'm not actively involved in it. But, you know, a friend of the show actually mentioned this, too, that there was very recently a new change to relating to mods. It's the Sims Marketplace, which is, like, a paid portal to get mods, and like that's really exploitative to the point where like Simfluencers are like starting to cut, or actually they have been. That actually was related to some of the EA issues, by which I mean the new ownership. So like, you know, between that a couple months ago with Simfluencers kind of jumping ship after the buyout of EA, with now these controversies with the Sims Marketplace, I kind of wonder if it is kind of the end of the Sims. And like I said, a friend of the show, Spring Mountain, who I know you know as well, had kind of tipped me into that, because I was like, oh, what's this about the Sims, when I saw them posting. So
yeah, well then let's move focus a little bit. We could actually dig into just The Sims a great deal more. I don't really have the range where The Sims is involved, however. Like, I understand it's a big topic. So I guess I'd like to move the discussion forward. And this is to note, you know, that a lot of games that have interior design as a primary gameplay element are viewed as or alongside cozy games, right?
Yeah.
There's been a real proliferation of these types of titles, including but certainly not limited to blockbusters like Animal Crossing, especially after COVID lockdowns, and even as recently as this month with the release of Pokemon Pocopia. It seems very clear to me from my perspective that interior design as a gameplay element has definitely gone mainstream. My perception of you, and I want to focus on Animal Crossing first, my perception of you has been an Animal Crossing fan since these games started coming over to the US. I guess I'd like to ask you a little bit about your experiences with these games.
Yeah, so I can't remember if I told this anecdote on our Animal Crossing episode, which was actually the last one we did before our unplanned hiatus. So I actually never owned a copy of the original GameCube game, but I did play it at the apartment of a college friend and his girlfriend. They were actually the ones who introduced that game to me. So like whenever I would go over there, hang out, have a couple drinks, jam to some music, we would spend a little time playing Animal Crossing, or like, because I think it was only one player at a time. So they would let me kind of go around and do things on their village. I did lose touch with them over the years, but, you know, thanks to them, that was my first experience with the series. And then, you know, shortly after that was when Wild World came out. And I definitely, for sure, I know I have talked about this on air, about how I would cut class in college and just hang out with my friends in the student union playing Wild World. But I think for the purposes of this episode, I really want to give flowers to Happy Home Designer for the 3DS. Like,
yes,
that's really where the franchise kind of stepped it up in terms of like how it integrated the housing mechanics. Like, I think that at least at the time, people were like, what? Why is this not just DLC or free content for New Leaf? Like, why is this a full-ass game? I get that. It probably should have just been DLC. That being said, like, if you think about the older Animal Crossing games, like, there were elements of, you know, furnishing your home. Like, that was definitely a part of it. But, like, you know, you had to place it and then, like, shove it around. It was pretty cumbersome. Like, the way that Happy Home Designer made it so that you could, like, you know, very easily lay out your furnishing and, like, preview it and all of that. I mean, not necessarily preview it, but, like, easily, like, oh, I'm going to put it back into storage. Like, you know, you think of, for those of you who have played Animal Crossing New Horizons, but maybe didn't play Happy Home Designer, like, the way that the housing design elements work in New Horizons is directly from Happy Home Designer. And I think that was a huge step forward.
Well, you know, it's funny to me that you say that, because I talked a lot, I think, over the last few weeks about how my recent Animal Crossing Renaissance was actually fueled by how much I enjoyed the Happy Home Paradise content, which is very much adjacent to what you're talking about right now.
Absolutely. And then the hotel as well, which, you know, on a much smaller scale, like,
The hotel for me is almost like a taster of the Happy Home Paradise. And like, if you enjoy this content, go do the full fat version, girl.
Absolutely. And I really enjoy those. You know, I see with Animal Crossing, not to get on an Animal Crossing tangent, like, the real emergent gameplay we saw was the way people transformed their outdoor spaces. And I would love to see the next Animal Crossing game have like the mechanics. Really kind of like even what we're seeing with Pocopia as well, like, kind of making it a little easier for placing things. You know, this is not an exterior design episode, but, you know, it's interesting to see how, like, that root in interior design and, you know, furniture, like, really kind of transformed the game. Because I think most of us in the Animal Crossing fandom are like, oh, I want, you know, like, to do this, this, and this in the next game. Like, I want to really be able to have, like, you know, more customization over the outside of my village. But I think it's important to remember where that ability to create started, which was from the interior design.
Absolutely. And, you know, I want to add, we've talked a lot, you and I, about where we think Animal Crossing as a series will go next. One of the elements I could see moving forward, I assume the Switch 1 on a tech level was not capable of doing this. Hopefully the Switch 2 is. I would really like to see those design tools that you have access to in the interior, have access to those design tools
in the
exterior as well, have a lot more customization options and focus and tools for the outside areas. I think once you start looking at how the game has developed, that's actually a very natural next step for the series.
For sure, because, I mean, the way that you have to move furniture around outdoors, that's what it was like to do your interior design. So, like,
well, yeah, and, you know, I've played the older games, and I've always really biffed on the, you know, long-term play. This is my recent Renaissance is the first time, like, I had like 60 consecutive days of logins. That's the first time it's been like that for me. And I really do think one of the big differences is how much more pleasant the interior design tools are to use. I've set up multiple themed rooms in my house this go around. I've never really done that before, but the tools now are easy and fun to use, and it really does make a difference. And I think that's why I want to see them expand on how and where they allow you to use those tools.
Absolutely.
Let's follow up then a little bit. I'd like to hear from you your experience of watching Animal Crossing go from a quaint little series that, as noted, the Nintendo 64 version literally didn't even get localized to, you know, it's now a major IP pillar for Nintendo.
Yeah, girl, it's been wild, girl. Listen, like, honestly, I would have even still considered Animal Crossing pretty niche, even with New Leaf. I mean, it was still pretty popular.
Yeah, I mean, it was in Japan, you know, getting theatrical anime movies, but certainly it, from an international perspective, in addition, like, it was nothing to the post-New Horizons era.
that anime movie is really cute. I really think they should do like a almost like Pokemon Concierge sort of collaboration with Netflix.
That would be cute.
That would be great.
Hell, you know, Netflix, just get Nintendo Pictures to do it like they did that Pikmin Close to You video. Upload it to Nintendo Today and YouTube. If Netflix wants to run it, license it out to them. But like, Nintendo doesn't even really need them for distribution anymore.
True. But that being said,
I mean, licensing it out to make money is obviously a good thing. I'm just saying they wouldn't even have to have a partner in order to do this.
Oh, absolutely. You know, so like, despite the fact that, as we said, that at least in the Western gaming world, that it was pretty popular, I would still have considered it kind of a niche IP for Nintendo. But like, obviously, I don't think anyone could have predicted the audience that New Horizons would have, including Nintendo. Like, I know people who traditionally aren't gamers, who never owned a console or gaming device in their life, who got a Switch thanks to the word of mouth about, like, yeah, this is just a really soothing and calming and cozy experience while the world is falling apart.
Yeah, I actually, to that exact end, during the pandemic, I saw a lot of the late night TV hosts making references and at times specific conversations about Animal Crossing. Specifically, John Oliver had done multiple Animal Crossing gags back at the time.
That does not surprise me. Yeah,
definitely. Yeah, not necessarily a space where you would have expected Animal Crossing to pop up. But like you said, it really went the distance because it was such a moment during the pandemic.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, I really think that the way that they have seen people use the gameplay systems as a way to express themselves creatively. I mean, we saw the Dream Islands added in, and I know that's, again, more like the outdoors, but I think they're really going to be looking at, like, how can they let players just create and build the little villages that they want for their cute little critters.
Yeah. Well, let's keep the situation. Let's keep the conversation going because we are beginning to get long in the tooth. I'd like to establish, right? I mentioned for me, one of my inroads to enjoying interior design as a game concept came with the MMO City of Heroes and by having been recruited into a subscription. I ended up really finding the fun for designing spaces, though, decades later, right? And it was largely the direct result of designing spaces for our free company house in Final Fantasy XIV.
Yeah.
I actually suspect that these housing systems in these MMOs end up converting a lot of us. But historically, you've experienced engaging with these systems way more directly than I have. So with that in mind, I'd actually like to put the floor to you for the MMO housing portion of the discussion. Because, for example, the old Final Fantasy housing system, I never engaged with it. I've only engaged with the current lottery, where I got the house I wanted in like 3 weeks. So tell me about it.
Yeah, yeah. So, and you know, there's a lot of MMOs that explore this. I believe Elder Scrolls Online is one that players like a lot with their housing elements. But for me, the first real MMO experience of this was the Garrisons in World of Warcraft. It was part of the Warlords of Draenor expansion, which was like a weird alternate universe. Not really alternate universe, but it was like alternate timeline, you know, going back to Draenor before it became the Outlands to, like, I don't know. I don't even want to try to remember how they explained it lore-wise, but, like, even though it wasn't really true housing, it was, like, instanced. It had, I remember, a certain degree of, like, oh, you could put this facility here, or you could use a different facility. So you had a certain degree of control over how to build out your own little space, and, like, then there were, like, garrison invasions. You had to protect it. So I just remember really enjoying that. As a change of pace.
Yeah, that's a great bit. I had a good time with that.
And then you also think of, they kind of expanded on that a little too with the farms in Mists of Pandaria, which really would be more of a kind of akin to like a Harvest Moon or something like that. But, you know, I still think adjacent in terms of having like your own little space that you're tending to. But it was definitely Final Fantasy 14 housing that was the one that really did it for me. Yeah, as you kind of alluded to, it used to be extremely competitive to get a house before the lottery system. Like, basically, you would have to stand there clicking on the placard, hoping that you got lucky. Like, I remember there were times where I would camp out, staying up all night on, like, you know, on a weekend night to try to click on it. And then I remember one time it was, like, 8 a.m. I had been up all night. I thought I got it, then someone next to me got it, and I was just like, ugh. Like, housing in Final Fantasy, to me, is enough of a draw and appeal to me that when I originally fell victim to the auto-demolition on my previous server, when my current character, who, you know, is part of our free company, was originally just an alt to play with some friends before, like, all the cross-server stuff was easier to do. I lost my house, and so I was like, oh my god, like, I am quitting this game. Like, I totally rage quit to the point where when I did decide to come back, my free company was like, no, we're not letting you back in.
Wow. Because
there was a whole thing. I'll tell you more about it offline, but yeah. So basically, the lottery system may not be perfect, and I know, like, on our server, which is a high population server, it can be a little difficult. That being said, there is a small house, like, literally right near me that has been, like, nobody's been on it for literally months. I mean, I haven't played in a couple days, so I'm like, maybe someone has it now, but, like, even on the, you know, most popular servers, like, you can still get it. You know, what I wanted to point out about Final Fantasy 14 is that, like, you know, the whole, like, trying to get a house, you know, that's, like, the true end game in Final Fantasy 14. But, like, it's pretty easy to get an apartment, which, you, of course, you know, you don't really get the exterior, but you get a little space, a little interior space. So, like, people who don't want to, like, be investing the in-game time or really money at this point, because it's not really as much of a time investment to, you know, secure housing, just, you know, over time. But, you know, it's pretty easy to engage with that. So I like that there are options for, you know, like, that most people can get. I can't imagine that there are even highly populated servers that don't have a couple of apartments open in one of the apartment wards. So, you know, that's at least something. The thing I really like about the housing in Final Fantasy 14 is just the freedom of design you're given. So, like, that means just, like, how you want to place the furniture, like, similarly to how Animal Crossing works now, but I would say, like, even more, because, like, some people are able to, like, glitch things and float things, to, like, make some just really wild spaces. Like,
yeah, it practically has meta mechanics.
For sure. Like, I tend to stay somewhat traditional in terms of how I approach my design. But, like, I love how you can, like, make it themed however you want. Like, I currently have a Domin-themed house because all the other houses in my neighborhood have that same exterior. So I was like, I want to kind of go with Eastern, Far Eastern elements. And, like, I really enjoyed kind of trying to use that as, like, almost the same way that the Animal Crossing, like, the Happy Home Paradise and stuff was like, I want a house that's, like, a French cafe. And so, like, you know, they give you recommended things. So, like, I kind of like imposing those sorts of challenges to myself. I'm glad you mentioned our free company house, though, because, like, even though I would say that you were kind of the primary, style specialist, which I swear that's just a way to call you an F-slur, your style sensibility.
I'm your style specialist.
It's giving very queer eye, but, like, I feel like if you go into our free company house, there's definitely elements that we all contributed. Like, And I like any time that I'm in there, I'm like, oh yeah, like I feel like this was really a true collaborative effort.
Collaborative
and I feel
design,
like,
yeah.
I feel like even Animal
like
Crossing
yeah, that I largely designed. Yeah. Even the basement, which like I largely ended up designing, like it was off of a prompt from you, very Happy Home Paradise style.
Yeah, and then your approach to that influenced how I did my basement and made it kind of like a performance venue. So yeah, I just really enjoy that. And I just love being in my space. There'll be times where like if I'm just really tired and I don't feel like running any content, but like you guys are online, I'll just like run around in my house or in my yard and just enjoy that space while I'm chatting. So I also want to give the honorable mention to the Island Sanctuaries. We alluded to them earlier. They are more like the WoW garrisons, I would say, but I want more little spaces that I can kind of build up. Give me more.
Indeed. All right, then I would like to move the discussion forward to the most recent major title that we will talk about experientially. This is, of course, last week's release of Pokemon Pocopia. Since its release, surprisingly successfully, Pocopia has surprised a lot of players by having no combat focus and being entirely a quote-unquote cozy game in the broad shape of a survival game, albeit minus most survival elements, and whose primary gameplay mechanic is arranging furniture to create habitats for Pokemon to chill at. I have found this gameplay to be immensely gratifying. It's almost low-key like a puzzle game meets Pokemon Snap. And given the game's seeming success, I mean, it's, you know, anecdotally, it's technically too soon to say for sure, although 2.2 million in just a couple of days does seem like a good sign. It sure does seem to me that I'm not the only one excited to engage in game worlds, particularly in Pokemon game worlds, with mechanics beyond commit violence. Slaggy, what is your experience of Pocopia from the perspective of your player response to the gameplay mechanics? And I want to note your overall impressions should be saved for What's Up and our larger conversation next episode.
Yes, yes. So, you know, the interesting thing, and I don't want to get too deep into this, is that, like, Pokemon Pocopia really pulled me in a way that, like, a Minecraft couldn't. And that's because, like, I enjoyed the idea of creativity in a Minecraft. I did not really want to engage in, like, the survival elements. Like, oh, guess I gotta, you know, run away from a creeper. Similarly with Lego Fortnite, which was, you know, basically Lego Minecraft in a way. So the focus on just making the little environments for the Pokemon, like, that, like, just does it for me. And, you know, it's funny because at first when I built my first little hut and it was, like, so small, I'm like, okay, so I still really like what this game's offering, but the housing elements are a little bit of a letdown. I guess, you know, maybe that was not as much of a part of the game as I thought it was. Then I finally built, like, one of the, like, full-size houses, which is, like, two stories, and I'm like, oh, okay, here we go. And then now seeing as I play through the story some of the other sorts of theming that you can have, like, for the other buildings, like, I just really love that, although there is the story, of course, that it really is like a big sandbox to play in, and you could do whatever you want with building out little habitats for your Pokemon.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I've had a really good time with Pocopia. I don't want to dig into that here, and I won't even dig into it too much during What's Up, because we have been moved to do a whole episode focus on it, because I think it's going to be such a title worth talking about. So with that in mind, then, I think it's time to start the wrap-up. As Pocopia has shown us, and as we're just talking about, for the most part, gamers are still responding positively to new combinations of integrating interior design mechanics into gameplay. So with that in mind, I guess I'd like to ask you, what other genres would you like to see experiment with interior design mechanics?
Like, honestly, put them in every game. Let's do like a puzzle with player housing. Let's do shmups with player housing. LOL. Like, I'm being mostly facetious here. But in all seriousness, a lot of RPGs already are kind of doing this to a degree. Like, obviously, you think of things like Skyrim, which I have never played an Elder Scroll. I probably should change that. But, you know, I know people love to build their houses or decorate their houses in Skyrim. You know, even things like Breath of the Wild and Tears of the Kingdom played around with this idea a little bit. Like, Tears of the Kingdom had the Tarrytown little modular houses you could build for Link, which was really fun. But then you also think of something like Cyberpunk, where you have V's apartment, like, which I, at least in my experience so far, I don't feel like you've had a lot of customization there. Like, my attitude is just, like, if you are in a world, like, have somewhere that could be your own little space in this world. Like, even Pokemon had the little underground hideouts in that one game. And, you know, so I think, like, any RPG, unless it's going to take away from resources of, you know, making the game better, like, put them in. Like, we sickos love that sort of side content, you know what I'm saying?
Right, you're not wrong. I saw what your next note was, and I'm 100 on board.
Yeah. So, like, I wanted to bring a little bit of a left of center thought, because we always said that, like, you know, Game Buoy was our, like, left of center port of call for gaming news and views, yada yada. I think it would be really cool to see this in a rhythm game, specifically like a Rock Band style game. Like, can you imagine, like, I really like how Rock Band Rivals did the story mode that was kind of like behind the music, and they were like talking about your band. Like,
yeah,
imagine if you had a game similar to that, where, like, at first it's just like you're kind of designing like what your tour bus looks like, and then how your rehearsal space is laid out. And then eventually you're getting, like, rich and famous, and you can buy houses and, like, decorate them. Like, I know that, you know, in these games, like, oh, you get money so you can buy better guitars and clothes. But, like, let's live the true rock star fantasy and buy a mansion in Beverly Hills or whatever. You know, like, Rivers Cuomo literally wrote a song about it.
Oh, my God. Take the Sim element deeper, right? And, like, we're going to film a music video, and it's going to be in our house is going to be in the background.
Right? Yeah, like, for sure. Like, I don't think
we can stage play tour songs on a set in our backyard.
Definitely. I don't think stage tour is going to be that sort of scale. Just knowing that Red Octane is, you know, an indie studio. So I think this is just kind of a pipe dream, but that would be, I think, the big one for me. I think, like, that would take so many elements of different genres that I love that you might not expect to be together.
Yeah. Well, then, in a more general sense, as a longtime fan of these kinds of games and the subgenre generally, what would you like to see more of from these kinds of games?
Yeah. So, like, you know, I think in terms of the interior design, again, just the ability to really continue expressing yourself creatively. But I think what I would love to see specifically with Animal Crossing, but also that kind of extends to the other ones, like, I would love to see interactivity with objects increase. Like, for me, like, in Animal Crossing specifically, the fact that I can put, like, a whirlpool tub in my house, but my villager can't go into the whirlpool tub, let alone, like, you know, ride on the Ferris wheel and stuff like that, right? Like, so I would love to see the not only the houses, but also, like, just all the objects, like, increasing the interactivity and immersion. And then just any sort of way that these games can create emergent gameplay opportunities. Like, you know, like, we saw Animal Crossing, like, one of our dear friends, Misha, friend of the show, like, over the pandemic would host little gatherings on her islands, and she would have, like, spin the wheel and get a prize. Like, you know, the ways that the social elements that these games can offer too. So like, even like we talked about with Final Fantasy 14 with collaboratively building the Free Company house out. And I know that Pocopia even has an element of that. And we see Animal Crossing exploring that as well. So I would say, yeah, interactivity and collaboration.
Excellent. And just, you know, full, I think that's,
you know, full sandbox. Yeah.
I think that's a great call out. The interactivity with objects in Animal Crossing and other games in this space is actually a real huge one for me. I have lightened up a lot, but my first thought, my first time playing Animal Crossing, even back on the GameCube, was like, okay, I'm setting up this foosball table. How come I can't now use it to play foosball? And I feel like that type of thing is really my fantasy, is like, I don't need to play a full foosball game or whatever, but like, if I interact with the foosball table, show me my character spinning one of the rods on it or something, right? Like, let me interact with every item in some way is really what I want. I don't need a whole ass mini game off every item, or even really any item, but I would like every item to have like a non-aesthetic reason to exist. That for me would be a big add.
For sure.
And obviously, control over environments, emergent gameplay. You're speaking my language, girl. These are literally the stuff, the threads that we've been talking about when talking about the growth of Animal Crossing and how Happy Home Paradise and its predecessor DLC on the 3DS really positively changed the direction of the series.
Oh my God, you know what I realized? I think especially for us as millennials trying to survive in today's economy, these games give a fantasy of home ownership.
Yeah, absolutely.
That being said, I do have a question for you. Like, we spent a lot of time talking about the gameplay mechanics, but I'm curious specifically about how you approach interior design. Like, some players may just literally not engage with these things and kind of just like randomly put stuff in their houses with no unifying theme or like honestly even any consideration for like aesthetic pleasantness. Then, you know, you have these like elaborate builds that I can't even imagine how to begin to put together. Like, for me personally, I go pretty traditional. Like, I definitely try to go for like at least a theme within a room, or like, you know, whether certain colors or certain types of furnishings. I really like to have a lot of open space in the center of the rooms that I design. That is also how I approach interior design IRL. Like, my room literally has stuff on the walls and then like a big rug in the middle. I'm curious about how you go about designing your living spaces in these games.
Yeah. So for me, it's kind of a combination of something between traditional design and also sort of like a gameplay first consideration, right? If I'm in that gameplay first consideration, and let me use Pocopia as an example, say I'm making my first base in a biome, that's going to be primarily its gameplay value for me is having a warp point to that new biome.
Yes.
So I'm really just going to be inclined to throw whatever's in my inventory in. If the only three items I have that are going to let this be established as a teleport house is a calendar, a potted plant, and a table, then that's what I'm going to throw in there. But generally speaking, I do get a lot more joy out of like a planned, thoughtful, methodical, and aesthetically pleasant approach, right? So like, I do, once I'm like, okay, I'm going to go head out to this building and that building, and I'm going to stock them up, then I am putting together, you know, furniture sets, or at least items specifically that I find aesthetically pleasant. As noted, using Animal Crossing as an example, I do enjoy, you know, coming up with a room theme. In Animal Crossing, like, I have a Zelda room, and I have a Twin Peaks room, and I have a skiing room. And it's, you know, it's just kind of all fun and really enjoyable to do. So it really, I do both. I'm not just one type of designer. I'm really a circumstantial designer, you know, based on the needs of the moment.
That's a really interesting point. Because I have not engaged with the housing design elements of Pocopia quite as much, because I have also been gameplay first and more focused on the story. But I am like, you know, interior design is kind of the end game, right?
It's funny you say that, actually. I stopped progressing my story in Pokopia on day like 3 or 4 because I speed ran the whole game because I couldn't put it down. And now I don't want it to finish. So I haven't turned in like the final turn in. And I'm just like sitting on it and now putting all my time into building up all my world. And I've heard what the endgame reward is. And I know it's one of those things that for a lot of people will make the endgame more appealing. But for me and the way my neurodivergence works, it's a tool I actively don't want. So I'm like, no, I think I'll wait and I'll finish it before next episode, of course. But right now I'm just really doing the things that I enjoy doing mechanically and just having a lot of fun with it.
Love it. I do have one final thought. I'm very surprised you didn't mention Tales of the Shire in this discussion. What are you, hobophobic or something?
Oh, that's so funny. The real answer to this, of course, is that if we were trying to be complete and do a, you know, the history of interior design in games, well, I probably would have played it just so that I could fairly remark on it. As it is, I can't talk about a game I never played and never considered. LOL.
Well, girl, I'm just joshing you. I heard that game was a hot mess. Like, we literally talked about it. Oh, we're long in the tooth.
Yeah, let's start winding down by talking about what's up.
I said, hey, what's going on?
You know who else is long in the tooth? Raikou.
Yeah, you're not wrong.
He's got cute form.
All right. First up this week, I have predominantly been playing Pokopia. I've been having a really good time with it. It has taken the majority of my gaming time since it came out, finally dethroning Animal Crossing as my daily played game. I'm really surprised by the tone, both of the game and of the story. I find it to be a really interesting take on the survival genre and really an evolution of a lot of the ideas at play in Dragon Quest Builders 1 and especially 2. That's a big thing for me. I've seen a lot of conversations about this game, talking about it as like a fusion of Animal Crossing and Minecraft in a way that is really highlighting to me and pointing out that a lot of people apparently did not play Dragon Quest Builders 1 or 2. There are a lot of ways in which Pokopia from a design perspective is almost like a Dragon Quest Builders 3 game. However, I don't really want to go too deep on specifics as we're going to be taking a deep dive on this game next episode. That having been said, I think Pokemon Pokopia comes with my highest possible level of recommendation. I am tremendously enjoying this game on pretty much every level, and I actively don't want to be done with it.
More like Dragonite Quest Builders, right?
Ah! Go for it.
Yeah. So I have also been playing Pikmon Utopia. It also has pretty much taken over my game time entirely. You know, just the Pokemon are so cute. It's really endeared me to, like, every Pokemon, even though, like, they might be ones that I might not really pay attention to in the mainline games. Their personalities are just so cute and funny, and I just find the gameplay loop really rewarding. I think what's kind of cool is that although I have been focused on the story, like, the first thing I would do in each zone is go and explore and like ended up finding things and achieving certain story or a certain quest criteria before even meaning to. And so I think that was pretty cool. Like, I could tell right away that this is a game with potentially unlimited gameplay, at least hundreds of hours if you really just want to explore it. I'll be shocked if this is not one of my 2026 Bowie Award winners. This is easily one of my favorite games in the Pokemon franchise, which is saying a lot for a game that's been out for, like, what, a week or two?
Yeah, right?
What else have you been playing?
The other game I did play this week is Animal Crossing. I have moved it into maintenance mode, so to speak. But I'm still logging in. Like, I had logged in multiple days this week and did my fossils and identifying them in order to fill out my museum. And, you know, I'm still trying to buy out the catalogs and collect as many of the DIYs. So, you know, I still kind of have goals, despite having achieved most of my goals. It's just really hard to keep focus when Pocopia is right there, and I'm frankly having an even better time with that game. That having been said, as I noted, I had like a 60 plus day Nook stop streak, and I ended up breaking it this week.
Oh, man.
And I will say that for me ended up being like the mental barrier. Like, once I broke that streak, I ended up having a couple of days where I didn't play the game. And prior to that, I really had been making it like truly a daily part of my routine. So, you know, it's been a little sad to transition away from, since it was kind of fun to do every day. But the flip is, it's because I replaced it with something else I'm enjoying. And I think that's okay.
Yeah.
What about you? What else have you been playing?
I was just saying, as far as Animal Crossing, like, I think that that's definitely where I was with my island for years. And then, you know, now again, after the rush of the 3.0 patch. But now your island is just there whenever you want to go, and it'll be your little cozy space. I just have to say, I think it's funny, and I'm happy for this. But, like, I was telling you earlier, like, at the very beginning of the year, might have been the end of last year, that I was like, oh my god, Animal Crossing 3.0, Pokemon Pocopia, and then Tomodachi Life, Living the Dream, like, it's gonna be a cozy game year. And you were like, oh god. And now, like, literally your what's up, we're all cozies. Like, I love this. Again, it's not like a it's not like a teasing thing. I'm like very happy that you are getting joy from these games. Is Pokemon Fire Red, although because of Pocopia, I have not touched it since Fire Red. I think I did the first night Pocopia, like, went and finished out one area I was in, but since then I have not, but I will get back to it. So I had left off just at Mount Moon, I believe, is what I had talked about the last time, and so since then, I went and did, like, the Cerulean Gym. I went down to do the SS Anne. I did the Vermilion Gym. Going through the Rock Tunnel was really tough, because I did not stop to think about how easily in the modern games, like, you'll just get random potions off the ground. So, like, I was like, ooh, I'm not used to having to stock up on potions. Like, I can only imagine if I ever did a Nuzlocke run, that I'm like, ooh, I would need to have plenty of potions and antidotes. Like, the fucking poison is the worst, girl. So, like, yeah, I was like, wow. But I made it through, like, you know, so it was kind of just interesting to see, like, ooh, that was a little RPG grindy, but, like, not in an unpleasant way. The Celadon Game Corner was a little bit of a disappointment. I remember you used to love the slots, and I'm like, no, these slots are janky. It's, giving some Games Hub gambling in games realness, and I don't like that. I picked up my Eevee from the Celadon Apartments. I decided to evolve her into Jolteon. I thought that would be fun. I went to Lavender Tower, and I got a Ghastly. And I ended up trading with myself to evolve my Graveler and my Haunter into Golem and Gengar specifically. Golem has been like my goat, literally. Like, not literally a goat, because he's not Go-Goat, but, like, he is like level 37, and, like, the next highest is Charizard is 36, and the rest are like early 30s, because, like, damn, like, I'm finding that, like, if I'm like, oh, I don't really have the type coverage, I'm just gonna throw out Golem and let him you know, get things done. And he's been really reliable. I actually went down from the Pokemon Tower to go down, you know, like the, where all the fishing, piers are, going, like, that way to Fuchsia City. Like, yeah, I went down that way, and I was like, oh, you know what? I'm going to sequence break, because that is the thing people do. But then I'm like, damn, why is the gym so much higher level? So I did go back, to Celadon after I hit up the Safari Zone. And I am currently saved in the Fuchsia Gym, where I'm like, why do so many of the trainers have psychics? This is the Poison Gym. Hello. I get it that they're like, ooh, we're jugglers, but we're also ninjas. The other thing is, like, why was psychic so OP in Kanto? Like, I understand why they introduced Dark and Steel, because, like, ouch. That being said, I am looking forward to playing more, but it will have to wait until I've kind of wrapped up my initial Pocopia tasks.
Indeed.
All right. Well, I guess that takes us to...
I was just going to say it's time to get the exit loot going.
All right. So our social links question of the week was, this week we're talking about our experiences slash opinions about interior design as a game mechanic. Do you enjoy this game mechanic? What are some of your favorite examples? Please only respond if you're comfortable with us reading your answer on air. Thanks. I know I don't always read that part. We got a response from Pod Culture. And the response was, I mean, I had a good time recreating the podcast studio as best as I could in Animal Crossing. And I know of many folks who spent days crafting just the right house in games like The Sims. Absolutely. I would love to see Pod Culture. I would love to see your podcast studio. That is actually something that I was thinking we should, with one of the Dream Islands on Animal Crossing, we should make a like little buoy island that has like some of the pirate themed items from like Gullivar.
Yeah, that would be cute.
With like a little podcasting studio.
Yeah, you know, I think we could maybe even do something like that in Pocopia using cloud islands. And in fact, there are like microphones and speakers and things in Pocopia. So I'm already like, Pod Culture just lit a fire in my brain. Let me put it that way.
Yeah, see, like, I forgot about cloud islands, but we will talk about that.
Indeed. Pod Culture, thank you for this feedback, because again, like I said, I think you just gave me a fun idea. And that sounds really cool, making a podcast studio in Animal Crossing. Now I kind of want to use one of my rooms for that.
Right? Or at the very least, a buoy island.
Yeah.
We'll do it. But for now, we need to wrap things up. So as ever and always, we love your feedbacks. We are deeply appreciative of your subscriptions, ratings, and reviews. You can find us on various social media mediums, such as Blue Sky at GameBuoy.org with an actual dot.
At GameBuoy.org with an actual dot.
Mastodon at GameBuoy at MSTDN.games.
Mastodon at GameBuoy at MSTDN.games.
We are also on YouTube. I have not been good about updating the YouTube description, so sorry. It just automatically syncs from our RSS feed. But like, if that's how you consume podcasts, we are just a podcast, because I know that many podcasts at this point have pivoted to video. No judgment. Some of our favorites have done that as well, but we are just a podcast. You can email us at mail... Oh, no, not mailbuoy at gamebuoy.org, because I don't know what happened to that address. But we're at gamebuoy.org at gmail.com with the .org spelled D-O-T-O-R-G.
At gamebuoy.org at gmail.com with the .org spelled D-O-T-O-R-G.
Yeah, I think, like, technically mailbuoy at gamebuoy.org still works, but I feel like when I was testing it out before we came back for our modern era, like, it wasn't forwarding right, so I'm like, we'll just use the Gmail. Of course, our home buoy base, Buoy Base Galaxy is gamebuoy.org.
Buoy Base Galaxy is gamebuoy.org.
And please let us know if there's somewhere else you'd like to see or hear Game Buoy. The podcasting landscape has changed a lot in the past few years. Also, the political landscape and the literal landscape. So if there's somewhere we should go that is where podcasts should be, please let us know. And where you should go are Friends of Buoy.
Do-do-do-do.
If you're friends with Buoy, then you're friends with me. If you're down with Buoy, then you're down with me.
I'd like to point you in the direction of OLR 2DX, where every geek has a voice, our friends and inspirations. Please join us in looking forward to the new OLR 2DX Odyssey. I'd also like to point you in the direction of Aftermath. In their own words, Aftermath is an independent, worker-owned website about video games, other media, and internet culture. In my words, they're the audience-supported site that many of our faves have landed at. We cite them all the damn time, and we strongly encourage you to check them out, as well as support them if you like what they do. I'd also like to point you in the direction of Game Mechanics, where they kick the tires and run diagnostics on tabletop experiences. Hosts Logan Jenkins and friend of the show Greg Leatherman have been playing games for decades and have designed several games themselves. Please check them out. You should also take a look at Walloping Web Snappers, a Spider-Man podcast. Doug and Derek dive into every Spider-Man cartoon ever made, from the swingin' 60s through the rockin' 90s, to Spectacular, Ultimate, and beyond. And last but certainly not least is new show Neo Geo Go, where Aaron and Andre take on the Neo Geo library chronologically and quickly. So far, their episodes have been under 15 minutes each. I had a lot of fun checking them out this morning, and I'm really into what they're doing. I am a noted diehard fan of the Neo Geo platform. Therefore, I strongly recommend you check it out. Slaggy, who would you like to point folks in the direction of?
Wow, imagine a show that was 15 minutes and not 3 hours. I would, of course, be remiss if I did not point you in the direction of The Bobby Blackwolf Show, a weekly internet radio show and podcast discussing the latest news in gaming, as well as sometimes reminiscing about gaming's history. Bobby is a founder of the Voice of Geeks Network, FOG Network, which we are proud members of. I'd also like to shout out to the Nintendo Pow Block Podcast, a dive into the week that was in the world of Nintendo, co-hosted by friend of the show Eddie V. I'd like to also direct you to the direction of Standard Issue Computing, which is a Blue Sky and blog run by another longtime friend of the show, where you can find retro and modern gaming in terms of computer games, hardware, software, and history. I would also love to highlight, as always, Sasha's Retro Bytes on Blue Sky for bytes of vintage gaming, including magazine scans and photographs. I'd also recommend you check out Defunct Games, your daily source for modern video game reviews, exciting trivia competitions, and old-school magazine analysis. And last but certainly not least, Thomas Game Docs on YouTube, where each video covers a different aspect of video game history, such as game development and sound design for beloved Nintendo franchises. And speaking of sound design for beloved Nintendo franchises, our wonderful theme music was done by the late, great Zelda Reorchestrated, which was a project that reorchestrated beautiful Zelda music into gorgeous symphonic sound. Thankfully, the legend continues in the form of ZREO Second Quest, so go check them out and share your support over at ZREOSQ.com. And I would not be recording without the help of our amazing robotic recording engineer. That is Craig, my hot robot boyfriend, who is a Discord app. Without him and his evil twin, G-Arc, Game Buoy would not be possible to record in the modern era. I mean, we probably would have found a way, but makes it a hell of a lot easier. Definitely check out Craig and G-Arc if you have Discord recording needs.
Did you say disco recording needs?
Well, Craig and I kiss all the time, disco occasionally.
Okay, as an aside, absolutely banger record.
Yeah, Harry Styles brings the bops.
All right, in the coming days, we'll be back at you in 2 weeks with a deep dive on all things Pokopia in an exciting look at this new Pokemon spinoff that has captured all of our hearts and imaginations. I do want to note this will be a spoiler-centric conversation. It is presently our plan to talk every aspect up.
Spoiler alert!
Through the ending. So yeah, there will be a spoiler alert in effect. It is my plan to actually finish the game by then. You know, we intend to discuss every aspect of this incredible game. So please look forward to that. But until then, keep gaming.
Keep gaming.
Keep thinking.
Keep thinking.
Stay safe.
Stay safe.
Stay strong.
Stay strong.
And see you, Space Cowboy.
See you, Space Cowboy. Yes, and I gather from your comments that there are a couple of other things you don't know, Marjorie. For example, you probably didn't know that Suzanne was the only contestant in Georgia pageant history to sweep every category except congeniality. And that is not something the women in my family aspire to anyway. Or that when she walked down the runway in her swimsuit, 5 contestants quit on the spot. Or that when she emerged from the isolation booth to answer the question, "What would you do to prevent war?" she spoke so eloquently of patriotism, battlefields, and diamond tiaras, grown men wept. And you probably didn't know, Marjorie, that Suzanne was not just any Miss Georgia, she was THE Miss Georgia. She didn't twirl just a baton, that baton was on fire. And when she threw that baton into the air, it flew higher, further, faster than any baton has ever flown before, hitting a transformer and showering the darkened area with sparks. And when it finally did come down, Marjorie, my sister caught that baton, and 12,000 people jumped to their feet for 16.5 minutes of uninterrupted, thunderous ovation as flames illuminated her tear-stained face. And that, Marjorie, just so you know, and your children will someday know, is the night the lights went out in Georgia.
I'm sorry. I didn't know.
Well, now you do.